Torchwood, Another Life. Written by Peter Angelides. Abridged by Joseph Lister. Read by John Barrowman.
Jack Harkness stood by the corpse. He tilted his head up towards the blue afternoon sky. "What do you see?" She studied the body. It lay half on the pavement and half in the gutter, legs folded over to one side, arms splayed out at shoulder height. The back of the head had leaked blood and brains into the roadway and wetted the otherwise dried mud that caked the nearby drain. "Same cause of death as the others," she said. "Look again." Gwen took a broader view of the alley. "This is a new location, still out of the way, secluded, but further into town." He dropped his gaze and his pale blue eyes stared directly at her. "Look again. Time of death must be early this morning." He clucked his tongue. "Let's leave that for Owen to decide at the autopsy. Now look again." Gwen stooped for a closer examination. She remembered where she'd seen this kid before. He'd been selling magazines by the market. He was one of the badge vendors who cheerfully cajoled shoppers to part with their money, and who didn't scowl even when the passers-by gave him the finger instead of cash. And now here he lay, dead, in a grubby back alley and splot. Someone or something had extinguished that lively look in his eyes by crushing the back of his skull. Crushing it so completely, Gwen already knew, that when they turned him over, they would be able to see the cracked remains of his top vertebrae.
"Youngster," Jack nodded, satisfied. "Won't be so hard for Tosh to cover up, because he won't be missed." "He will be missed." Gwen was surprised how angry she felt about it. "He'll be missed by me. I've seen him selling the big issue in town." "So what's his name?"
"That's not what I meant, and you know it." Jack smiled at her.
"It's all relative," Jack said. "Which of us will be missed? And when? Next year? 10 years? A century? When they're building the next Millennium Stadium in Cardiff, or whatever Cardiff has become by then, who will miss any of us?"
Gwen stood up again. "Sometimes I don't think you care about anyone." Jack was angling his mobile phone at the dead youngster. He had the mobile on speaker so that he could talk to Toshiko at the same time as transmitting a crime scene image back to her at the hub. "Starting to look like we've got our man, Tosh. So where is he?"
"Working on it, Jack," Toshiko's voice told him from the radio.
"Are these pictures any good?"
"They're ideal," enthused Toshiko. "I can cross-reference the upload with structured information and pictures and captions from the police national database. Smart stuff they've got."
A breeze was starting to lift litter down the narrow alley and swirl it around their feet and onto the corpse.
Gwen studied the sky. Dark gray clouds were obscuring most of the blue now.
"Weather's deteriorating."
"Yeah," said Toshiko's voice. "There's a strange cold front over the city. Not what we'd expected from the forecast. Plenty of rain on its way, and the temperature's unusual for this time of year. Low 60s.
Jack pulled up his collar as the breeze stiffened. "Okay, Tosh, your smart system has had plenty of time now. Where's our killer?"
"Already left his office. Office mates said they thought he was going into the city center, not back home. Then we lost his trail behind a lorry on the M4 and missed his exit junction."
"Options?"
"I'm trying to get his secretary," said Toshiko, "and we're still scanning for his car."
Jack considered the corpse at his feet. "All right, Gwen and I are going into the center. Tosh and Owen, we need cleanup here for the corpse."
"Location? Got it from your GPS signal," Toshiko said. "Postcode CF249XZ. You're in Splot."
They sat in the Casticelli Cafe and watched the street outside. A couple of city types sprawled at an adjacent table leered at Gwen. Jack propped himself in a metal chair, still wearing his greatcoat, but draping it so that the chair back was between his body and the coat. By sitting next to him, Gwen got the same clear view of the street. Ideal on a sunny day and still acceptable as the sky became more overcast and early evening began to draw in. There was a pre-storm smell in the air, the ozone tang of unspent lightning, Jack had called it as they sat down. Gwen fumbled for her palm-top computer and called up the image that Toshiko had sent them. The screen showed her a badly lit, flat-featured picture, a face with the rictus grin that characterized any security photo. Guy Wildman, early 40s, gray suit, collar to match his hair. What made him the killer of four vagrants in Cardiff?
She and Jack observed the pedestrians flowing through the street. An old lady in a patterned headscarf hobbled along, a Tesco bag in each hand. A blue one-man dust cart paused to empty a waste bin. Jack was on his feet immediately, getting an unobstructed view, shooing the driver on, watching the street beyond. Watching two teenagers as they idly peered through a newsagent's window, their shirt tails stuck out below their school pullovers. Watching a bleach blonde woman in fuck-me shoes totter in the opposite direction with a supermarket trolley full of groceries. Watching a crumpled man thread his way through the thinning crowds on his way north. Watching him shoot looks to left and right. Watching him clasp his briefcase firmly in one hand and clutch his collar tightly to his throat with the other. The man's demeanor drew attention to him. He was in a hurry, but trying not to look it. He was gray-haired, disheveled, on a mission. He was Guy Wildman.
"That's our boy," said Jack. He swerved around the dust cart and maneuvered into the street, 30 meters behind the target. Gwen fumbled her palm-top computer into her jacket and started after him. As she did, her sleeve caught the half-empty glass of lemonade. The glass fell, rolled across the table, and smashed on the pavement. Wildman heard the noise, turned, and saw Gwen. She flicked a look at Jack, immediately cursed at her own tactlessness. Wildman was already looking back at Jack, seeing Jack's hand reach beneath his greatcoat for a weapon. A panicky look of disbelief, and Wildman darted into a side street and away. Jack was after him in an instant. Pedestrians scattered like a flock of startled pigeons as he burst through their midst. Gwen launched herself after him, half colliding with the woman pushing the supermarket trolley. She ignored the woman's stream of obscenities and chased down the side street after Jack. Far ahead of them, Wildman was rounding the next corner. As she approached it at a run, Gwen could hear angry shouts and swearing. She turned into the alleyway and found half a dozen school kids gesticulating after the disappearing Jack. A ginger-haired lad had been knocked down in the rush. One of his friends was helping him to his feet again, and another was recovering his scattered ciggies from the gutter. Gwen hopped around them, still staring down the alley at Jack, who was about to turn another corner. She had dropped well behind now, 50 meters at least. It was obvious from the way Jack was running that he'd taken out his revolver, and it was also apparent that he was unable to take clear aim at the fleeing figure of Wildman. Too many early evening pedestrians were wandering these side streets. A group of girls from a private school, incongruous in their expensive blazers, formed a buzzing crowd outside a clothes shop. Two businessmen walked in parallel, but were oblivious to each other in their separate mobile phone calls. A couple of dusty construction workers laughed as they began to secure a makeshift door in the chipboard wall around the building site. Their manner told Gwen that it was the end of their shift. Their yellow hard hats were clipped to their belts and their fluorescent jackets were off their shoulders and hanging behind them from the waist. So they were unprepared for Wildman to barge straight at them. One he smacked with his shoulder and the other caught a solid blow when Wildman swung the side of his briefcase into the man's head. They stumbled aside, and Wildman pulled the door open again. The workmen staggered back to their feet and cursed him with the fluency of long practice. The younger man, a crew-cut teenager, had taken the blow from the briefcase. He was attempting to seize Wildman by grabbing onto his raincoat when Jack approached at full pelt and yelled at him to step aside. Wildman struggled at the door, fumbling with the latch and open padlock. He glared at Jack and seemed to convulse. From her perspective, still halfway down the alleyway from him, it looked to Gwen as though Wildman was going to be violently sick. She heard a plopping sound, and Wildman regurgitated a green-gray bolus at Jack. Jack stepped aside with a surprise yell, bumping into the two construction workers. Wildman took his chance in the confusion. He almost wrenched the door off its rusty hinges and dived into the building site. The construction workers were staring at whatever Wildman had sicked up. It hadn't splattered as it hit the ground. It just lay there, pulsing slightly. Jack reached out one foot, trod the thing into the dusty pavement, then he kicked it through the door and disappeared into the building site. Gwen pounded up the street to the door and brandished her ID card. The older of the two workers stared at her. "What's going on?" "The bloke's not well. He was throwing up. What was that?" The door was slightly ajar, and he was about to open it for a look, but Gwen pushed it shut again. "I just need you to get out of the way. Anyone else in there? Anyone arriving for another shift?"
We're the last, just locking up, said the younger man. She pointed to the yellow hard hat clipped to his waist. I'll need that. He hesitated. Come on, we haven't got all day. She pulled the door open. Lock this behind me. Beyond the chipboard barrier, it was gloomier than in the street outside. Gwen paused for a moment to let her eyes adjust. She tried the hard hat and found that the guy's head was much bigger than hers. She gave up trying to adjust it and placed the hat on the edge of a rusty yellow skip. The thing Jack had kicked through the door had fetched up against the angled side of the skip. It had unfurled now, like a snot-colored starfish with four legs. The thing quivered for a moment before it went stiff, leaking yellow bile into the gray dust. Gwen could hear running on the floor above her. She scanned this floor and saw where they must have gone. She stepped through a gap in the wall where the doors would later be fitted and looked up into the stairwell. Concrete stairs made a four-sided spiral up into the building. There were no rails in place, so she hugged the wall, staying well away from the edge where, flight by flight, the drop became sheer and more disorienting. Her lungs were starting to burn as she approached the eighth floor. Beyond the next landing was the scuffling sound of shoes on concrete. Gwen slowed her progress and peered out carefully. The early evening sun fell in a brilliant shaft of light, angled through the whole area. Concrete reinforcement wire poked out of blocks in the center. She could see through the unfinished floor and again through the next three floors below that. On a crossbeam in the center stood Jack. He was balanced, apparently unconcerned by the dizzying gap below him, and with his pistol trained on the far side of the shell of a room. Wildman had picked his own way carefully over the fretwork of connecting girders, and now scrambled over the partly constructed exterior wall and onto the raised wooden and metal framework that surrounded the building. He had to use both hands to balance, and then to grasp the weathered steel of the scaffolding and hoist himself out onto the ledge. Wildman peered behind himself, out across the city. While he did this, Gwen shuffled carefully into the room. She could now see through the skeleton of the building at this height, and a momentary nausea washed over her. She clutched at the wall to steady herself. Wildman swiveled back around to consider Jack again, careful not to overbalance on the scaffold platform. Gwen could see now that the top of Wildman's gray jacket was wet and dark. The vivid red splash on his white shirt indicated that it was blood. He was breathing more easily now and smiling broadly.
Okay, so you checked out the view, Jack called to Wildman. And you know you're going nowhere.
Wildman cocked his head to one side, contemplating Jack.
That weapon is a fascinating item, he said.
His voice betrayed him, no worry. Just amused interest. Jack's aim didn't falter.
Step back into the building, away from the edge. I think I'm safer where I am. Why don't we just continue our chat right here?
Jack moved his head to one side.
Okay. So maybe we start with the obvious stuff. Like, what's your connection to the deaths of four vagrants? The ones that were found within a few minutes walking distance from the offices of Bly Droog Nuclear Research Facility.
Wildman tutted.
Shocking. I saw that on the news. And their deaths matched the time that you were just about to enter work, or you just left. We checked your ID badge accesses at Bly Droog. They all match.
Wildman's smile didn't change.
Do they? You even snuck out one lunchtime. What was that about? It's no crime to take a walk at lunchtime, observed Wildman. You were killing people, not killing time.
How dreadful, said Wildman.
You murdered them by biting into the back of their necks.
Wildman laughed in disbelief.
In fact, persisted Jack, isn't that spinal fluid now? There, down your chin, all over your shirt collar.
The breeze through the building had begun to stiffen now. The melancholy wail of a police siren carried up to them from the street as it drew nearer. Wildman took another look backwards into the street far below, returned his gaze to Jack. He didn't look angry. He was calm.
Come on, Wildman. There's no escape from this.
Gwen here behind me, you've seen her. She's called the police, so even if you get past me, and you won't, you wouldn't beat the cordon around this building.
Come on, away from the edge now!
Wildman raised his left arm, slowly so that it wouldn't alarm his captor, studied the watch that poked out beyond his soiled cuffs. Time of death. He murmured to himself. He lowered his arm and studied his feet with a look that suggested he had never seen them before. Gwen saw Jack's arm tense up.
"Don't fool around, Wildman. I can take you out from here."
Wildman looked up from his shoes. He stared past Jack, at Gwen. He was grinning now, like it was all a huge joke. He switched the grin back to Jack.
"See you again," he said cheerfully.
Wildman allowed himself to fall. His feet didn't move. His arms remained by his side. He just dropped backwards, as though it was a trust exercise and someone was going to catch him. But no one could catch him. The green netting parted soundlessly behind him. Guy Wildman was still smiling as he plunged backwards, head first, and tumbled to his death.
Gwen pushed her way through the police cordon. Her words were, "Excuse me," and "Sorry," as she moved the police constables aside. But her tone was, "Get out of my way." She knew that coppers responded to the sound of authority were less likely to question her seniority because they were accustomed to simply obeying orders that were spoken clearly and unambiguously. It was a technique she'd seen the other Torchwood members use. The only time it was awkward was when she came across her former colleagues, like Andy Davidson. Once upon a time, he'd been showing her the ropes. Today, she was asking him to stay behind them.
"We've got to stop meeting like this," Andy said to her. But she noticed that he still held the yellow and black cordon tape up for her.
"People will start to talk."
"Thanks," she said, stooping under the tape. "I imagine people are talking anyway, aren't they, Andy?"
"Special ops," he said.
"Bound to have tongues wagging, isn't it?"
She let Andy guide her down the road and along the length of a bus that seemed to have stalled in the middle of the carriageway.
"Can this be moved?" she asked him.
"Wait and see."
They rounded the front end of the bus. The windscreen was a crazed spider's web of splintered glass with a long smear of blood down its full height. The diesel engine was still chattering away, and the crumpled remains of Guy Wildman lay sprawled under the front wheels. He was determined, this bloke, 8 floors down, smacks into the top of the bus, slides down the front, bus doesn't stop in time, finishes the job. A dark pool was spreading beneath the bumper. Scraped him along the tarmac for several meters, and he sucked in air through his teeth, like a plumber appraising a quotation.
"I suppose we'll be left to shovel up the bits as usual."
He shook his head.
"Anyway, suicide isn't very special ops, is it? I'd have thought you'd be investigating all these vagrant murders. Serial killer, isn't it?" He wasn't deterred by her silence.
"Can't you tell us anything, Gwen?"
"I would tell every one of you," she said gently. "Except I'd have to become a serial killer myself." Andy studied her thoughtfully.
"I'm starting to believe that you're not joking when you say things like that." He concealed his disappointment badly.
"Oh, well, I'll get the forensics team out here."
"Not this time, Andy." Gwen felt that keen awkwardness again, the sense that she was clumsily rejecting her friends on the force and couldn't yet find a graceful way to do it. As if to underline this, Owen brusquely charged up to them.
"Are you coming, Gwen?"
He had stopped right in front of Andy, like he didn't exist. Tasha snapping on her rubber gloves. "And you're not going to want to miss this one." Owen strode off around the bus. Gwen shrugged a kind of apology at Andy, giving him a tight smile while looking meaningfully over his shoulder to the cordon.
"Ah, all right then. Well, be seeing you."
He turned on his heel and retreated, away from the scene of crime. Gwen wasn't sure whether she heard correctly, but she suspected he'd sarcastically added a murmured ma'am before he went.
"Whoa!" yelled Owen.
He stood up and banged on one of the unmarked parts of the windscreen.
"Tosh, what are you doing with that bus driver?"
Toshiko's head appeared through the driver's side window. "He's in no fit state to drive. You can talk. Try reverse gear, would you? I want some of him left for the autopsy."
There was a horrendous grinding of gears, and the whole bus seemed to shudder. With a reluctant groan and a startling hiss of air brakes, the vehicle slowly moved backwards. From beneath the front of it emerged the gory mess of Guy Wildman. The shattered remnants of his head lay in a bloody pool that encircled it like a gruesome halo. There was so much blood that it created a reflective surface in which Gwen could see the streetlights that had started to come on around the scene of the accident.
Owen considered the brutalized remains and began snapping photographs on a digital camera. Toshiko joined them by the body. She'd given up trying to park the bus neatly and had left it jackknife with two wheels across the opposite pavement. Did he jump, or was he pushed? Suicide. Gwen remembered Wildman's demeanor beforehand. So different from the panic he'd shown when fleeing from them in the street. He was absolutely calm, she said, smiling at us. He was ready when he finally jumped.
Jumped?
Toshiko was surprised. No, Gwen corrected herself. He didn't jump. He simply let himself fall, dropped off the floor like he was collapsing backwards onto a bed.
Not what it looked like from down here, Toshiko said. He screamed, threw his arms about like he was flailing, offered Owen.
He didn't start screaming until about halfway down. He stared at the corpse.
Maybe you changed your mind, eh? No going back on that decision, mate.
Owen drew back the smeared raincoat to reach into the corpse's jacket pockets. This brief search produced a crushed wallet and an ID badge from the Blydrug Research Facility.
We got the right bloke, then.
I think God is putting a positive spin on it, Jack called from above them.
Gwen had left Jack back on the 8th floor when she'd hurried down to see what had happened to Wildman. He must have decided to descend in style, because he was using the builder's lift down the side of the building. As it started to vanish slowly behind the chipboard barrier that surrounded the lower floor, he jumped onto the top of the wooden partition and then leaped the remaining 7 feet to street level.
As interrogations go, Jack concluded, it wasn't one of my best.
He cast a glance at the gathering crowd of rubberneckers. Get him back to the hub and do the autopsy there.
Great, moaned Owen. We've got one corpse in the SUV already, and now we have to fit us and this carcass in there.
Quit griping. That car's deceptively spacious, Jack told him. Gwen and I will take the other vehicle.
Let me think, Owen said. Whose conversation will I enjoy more on the journey? A dead guy's or Jack's?
See you back home, Jack told him. Gwen watched Owen's face darken as he twisted to watch Jack walk away. Maybe it was just a trick of the light. She started after Jack. Owen was still complaining to Toshiko. Let's get this stiff shifted. What I need is a really big spatula and gloves. I hate it when I get bits of brain under my nails. Gwen made her way down the short flight of steps that led to the walkway across the shallow basin. She was still amazed by the way the hub was aligned with the surrounding area above ground. A clue was the tall stainless steel pillar that reached from the basin up to the distant ceiling, where it continued up another 70 feet beyond the pavement of Roald Dahl Plas, opposite the Millennium Center. Constantly flowing water cascaded like a shimmering curtain on all sides of the pillar. The basin itself seemed to rise and fall with the tide. Gwen met Jack at the top of the spiral staircase that led to the boardroom. He stared out over the main area, evidently enjoying the sight of his team busy at work.
Saw you talking back there with the policeman. He giving you a hard time?
No, not at all. Gwen considered how she'd felt talking to Andy in the alleyway. Or not talking to him, more like.
Sometimes I just hate keeping secrets. Sometimes I wish people wouldn't tell me them. Then there's no pressure. Know what I mean?
Part of the job, he told her.
Everyone, his voice trailed off. He'd seen Yanto, their receptionist, walking up the spiral staircase. He was headed for the coffee machine and smiled as he spotted them leaning against the balcony rail.
He waggled a coffee pot at them. I was about to get fresh. Jack smiled at this comment and gestured for Gwen to follow him through the glass doors into the boardroom.
We'll take it in here, Yanto. Thanks.
They tripped the motion detectors as they went in and the strip lights blinked on. At the same moment, there was a buzz of power as the wall-mounted plasma screen behind Gwen faded into life. Toshiko joined them and sat quietly at the opposite end of the oval conference table. A minute later, Owen was clattering up the metal stairs to join them. He was still wearing his white lab coat over his crumpled t-shirt. He peeled off the coat, spotted that there was nowhere to hang it, and bundled it under the table before taking his seat. They settled into their places around the table, while Yanto delivered the coffee. I've completed the movement analysis that pinpoints Wildman, Toshiko began. I cross-correlated the locations for the deaths of all the vagrants. She displayed a list of names on the main screen. A substantial minority showed only as A.N. Other. She continued,
Now, it's not unusual for vagrants to drop down dead, even at this time of the year when the weather's still quite warm, so I obviously eliminated the less dubious cases. Any of them that hadn't had the backs of their neck and skull chewed off? Owen said. Toshiko frowned at him. These victims aren't exactly missed and mourned. No one's looking for them. They're already missing, so they can drop down dead and nobody cares. That means that wildlife might predate the bodies.
Ew, said Gwen. Predate? Like predatory? You mean eat them?
Of course. Toshiko tapped at her PDA screen with a stylus. The main screen in the room flashed up a shorter list of the names. The victims we're interested in have had their heads chewed by human teeth. There's no connection with where they live, or used to live, I should say. Some of these addresses are from many years ago. Toshiko called up another screen of information, this time a map of the whole Cardiff area. There were two clusters of red dots and one solitary dot at a distance from them. She indicated the largest cluster. As you can see, they're all within easy access of the Blydrug offices. There's one isolated similar case out in the Wetlands Nature Reserve, from some days previously. And then there's a smaller cluster here. The nearest things to that are a tourist center, an army training camp, and the town of Cowbridge.
Excellent work, Tosh. Jack was clearly pleased.
Okay, we need to see if anything tiles Wildman in with the other cluster.
Mr. Harper, what have you got?
Dr. Harper, if you don't mind. Owen flipped open the top of his laptop and thumped at the keys to get his information displayed on the plasma screen. I used that Becker and deep tissue scanner for some of these, Owen was explaining, so I could get some initial snaps without any invasive procedures. The images were displayed on the wall screen, bright red and cream images of flesh and blood and bone. Amazing, innit? It's like it peels away the outer layers or makes them invisible or something. Toshiko looked up idly from her laptop screen. So why bother with the autopsy, then?
Wait and see, Owen admonished her.
He ran through the images on the display. Many of the pictures showed Wildman's corpse with its arms spread, skin flayed back, the chest exposed and the abdomen open. The traditional Y-shaped incision had been made from shoulders to mid-chest and on down to the pubic region. Wildman's face was smashed into an unrecognizable pulp, even after it had been cleaned up. There were more pictures. Owen had cut the cartilages to separate the ribs from the breastbone. They were smashed upon landing, he explained. And when I entered the abdominal cavity, you could see that the large intestine had been lacerated by a penetrating injury sustained on impact. So freeing up the intestine took some time. Nothing of great interest for most of the organs. No bacteria in the blood. No indication of drug use, prescription, medicines, or poisons. He put up some new images, examinations of the esophagus, stomach, pancreas, duodenum, and spleen. Non-human elements there. That creature that he threw up at Jack, interrupted Gwen.
Genius, said Owen laconically. There's also an alien device inserted in his spine, attached to the spinal column quite near the top, and here it is.
He produced the thing with a flourish. It was spherical, about the size of a large marble, but with a dull chrome finish. There were three short spiked attachments to one side of it, which Gwen assumed were how it had been fixed in place. Toshiko took it from Owen and placed it into a small container. She attached that to her laptop and started to scan its contents.
Good work. Tosh, what have you got?
Results are coming through. She touched her keyboard and her screen replaced Owen's on the huge plasma display on the wall. Owen sat down and stared at the screen. She gets the jobs that take her a couple of minutes, and then this whiz-bang technology does the grunt work for her. Why do I get the jobs that mean spending 2 hours up to me elbows in someone else's cold, dead guts? Toshiko patted his arm on the table to make him shut up. It'll take a while because it has to do a content search on multimedia databases around the UK. Oh, I checked out the security reports from the place Wildman worked, the Blydrug facility. Do you think it's too much of a coincidence that a number of their new experimental nuclear power packs have gone missing?
Jack's eyes widened.
Didn't see that on the news. Well, it's not something they've made public. Her voice trailed off as an extraordinary figure entered the room. The inflated white suit and cumbersome cylindrical helmet made it difficult for him to get through the doorframe. When he managed this small feat, he waddled across the meeting room towards them. Gwen could hear his breath hissing through a speaker on the side of the helmet.
It took her a moment to see through the visor that it was Yanto. He brandished a Geiger counter at them. It was already clicking alarmingly.
I took the liberty of scanning the corpses in the mortuary, Yanto began, and I regret to say that one of them is highly radioactive.
Okay, said Jack. Not too much of a coincidence, Dosh.
Yanto was quickly scanning them each in turn. The ratcheting sound of the Geiger counter didn't increase when it ran over Jack or Toshiko. It stayed the same when Yanto motioned it against Gwen, too. She stepped out of the way to let Yanto waddle further into the room alongside the table. The Geiger counter crackled and spat violently when Yanto placed it against Owen.
Up to me elbows in the corpse, he shrugged. For 2 hours. What did you expect?
The rest of you are within safe limits, Yanto confirmed. I'm afraid that Owen's close proximity to the irradiated cadaver means that he will need decontaminating.
Jack reappeared through the door. He carried a wooden box, teak with brass hinges and an elaborate clasp. He placed it on the table, unfastened the clasp, and from the velvet-lined interior of the box withdrew what looked like a squat loofah.
Owen eyed this novel new item. If you think I'm going to scrub it all off with that, Jack held up the loofah and waggled it at Owen until he took it from him. This will soak up 6 types of radiation.
Six? Owen looked impressed.
I can only remember 3 types.
Well, I got a deal on that thing, Jack explained. Keep it with you, probably for the rest of the day.
He took the Geiger counter off Yanto and handed it to Owen.
You should stay in the hub until the REM count for your absorbed dose gets down to here. Jack indicated a reading on the counter. Tosh, you can keep him company while you complete the search for that thing in Wildman's spine. Gwen, you're coming with me to search Wildman's apartment for the source of this radiation. I think we can guess what that is, but if it's as radioactive as Wildman, we should make it safe.
Ah, thank you, Yanto.
Yanto had brought 2 more Geiger counters, each the size of pocket calculators. Jack put one in his jacket and handed the other to Gwen.
Gwen held it at arm's length across the table towards Owen. The dial flicked up into the danger zone.
You should have said we were going to Wildman's, Jack. I could have met you there in the first place, saved myself a journey here.
What? Asked Jack, leaving the boardroom and strolling out into the hub main area.
And miss seeing Owen glow in the dark?
He stepped beside the stainless steel fountain that stood so incongruously in the middle of the area.
Jack pressed the button and Gwen could see far above them a piston pushing aside a paving stone in the ceiling. It was immediately obvious that the weather had worsened since she'd arrived. A sprinkling of rain started to spatter down on them, and water began to flow over the sides of the hole. Jack leapt out of the way of the downpour and immediately closed the gap again.
Okay, that's not going to work for me. Let's go out through reception.
Wildman's apartment was in a 3-story building. Gwen huddled next to Jack under the concrete awning that was failing to provide much shelter from the rain. The main doors were stout, green-painted with artless graffiti scrawled in marker pen. Residents' names were written more tidily than the graffiti on plastic-covered scraps of paper next to the illuminated push buttons. The doors opened into a dingy hallway. 2 doors to the left, with 2 more opposite, a flight of steps rose into the darkness further down on the right. The hall was flanked by 2 scratched side tables, one covered in free newspapers and uncollected mail. Jack scanned through letters but found nothing for Wildman. He took a reading from the Geiger counter, but it ticked softly in the safe zone. Gwen made her way up the concrete stairs. Through the big picture window, she saw the rain drumming down on a backyard containing dustbins and a half-filled rusty yellow skip. She and Jack reached the top of the next flight of stairs. Jack scanned again for radiation and was satisfied when he found the area uncontaminated. Wildman's apartment was 1 of 2 on this 2nd floor. The door to number 7 was painted in a cherry red that made a cheerful contrast to the other apartments that they'd seen so far.
Yale lock, Gwen told Jack. Might be double locked. But we know he's not in anyway.
She kept a lookout, watching for movement up and down the stairs, while Jack attempted to slip the lock.
Oh!
Something surprised Jack. Gwen looked over to see that he was pocketing his Geiger counter but drawing his revolver from its holster. He mouthed, "Doors already open," to her. She reached for her own concealed weapon. Jack pushed the apartment door open with his toe, and they both flattened themselves against the wall either side of the outer frame. There was no response from inside.
Jack swung around, his legs braced and his Webley held in a double-handed grip. From inside the apartment came a shrill scream and the sound of glass breaking.
"All right, ma'am," Jack said, and stepped slowly through the doorway. "Stay calm. No cause for alarm."
Gwen followed him into the apartment. A woman had pressed herself up against the striped wallpaper just inside the main room, her eyes widened, scared, unblinking. She couldn't take them off Jack's revolver. "Please don't shoot! Don't hurt me!" At her feet were fragments of a small glass-topped table and the ornaments that had stood on it. The woman had overturned them in her fright. Jack raised his voice so that Gwen could hear from her position in the narrow hallway behind him.
"Stay back for a moment while I sweep the place!"
From her position in the hallway, Gwen could see Jack kick open doors to places off the main room. Bedroom, bathroom, saloon doors through to a kitchen area. Eventually, he called to her that the apartment was secure. Gwen moved into the room and holstered her weapon. "It's okay," Gwen reassured the frightened woman. "We're police, special operations." She showed the woman her ID. "What's your name?" The woman seemed to slide down the wall as she relaxed a little. "Betty Jenkins." She had a South Wales accent. Jack was openly scanning the room with the Geiger counter. On the scratched coffee table was a single dirty coffee mug with a small plate of crumbs beside it. By the door was a sideboard that must have been the height of fashion 40 years ago. Its formica top covered in old magazines, junk mail, and a battered letter opener. Wildman's apartment walls held photo enlargements and A4 clip frames. Most showed images of colorful tropical fish against the startling grandeur of a coral reef. One showed a trio of people ready to dive on a boat that floated in azure water beneath a cloudless blue sky. They were in wetsuits, masked up, thumbs raised, and their brightly colored scuba gear made them seem as exotic as the fish. Gwen helped Betty to the nearest armchair. The frightened woman sank into it gratefully. She pulled the tails of her navy-colored coat into her lap and smoothed it over her knees. "I'm Gwen. Now what are you doing here, Betty? Do you know Mr. Wildman?" Betty took a deep, shuddering breath in, terrified. "It's okay. We're concerned about Mr. Wildman and his whereabouts. We want to help him." After a while, Gwen knew the half-truths and misrepresentations came more easily. Wildman was stone-cold dead, glowing slightly on a slab back in the Hub's mortuary. "Do you know where he might be, Betty?"
"He's in Egypt. Said he was going on a dive with some tour firm in Dahab, in the Red Sea. I joked with him that he'd never get below the surface because of all the salt, and he laughed because he said I was mixing it up with the Dead Sea."
She trailed off, her voice failing. "Oh God, tell me he's all right. He's not dead, is he?" Gwen shushed her and held her shoulders to calm her. "It's all right. Don't worry." Wildman can't have been thinking things through properly, Gwen thought, because he'd been going to work for the past week. Toshiko had deduced that much from the badge in records. It was uniquely Wildman's thumb that proved he'd been in Wales and not Egypt. So why had he told Betty he was going to be in Egypt? Gwen kept her voice soft. "What's your connection with Mr. Wildman?"
"Neighbor," sniffed Betty. She plucked a hanky from her cardigan sleeve, wriggling awkwardly where she sat in the large chair.
"I've been feeding his plants for him while he's been away." She was constantly watching Jack, warily considering his moves around the apartment as he continued to scan his Geiger counter. He must have sensed her gaze because he turned away from the kitchen area and treated her to one of his unexpected, dazzling smiles. Gwen wondered if he was hitting on Betty. She was slim and fit with short-cut blonde hair and striking cheekbones. Her dress fell to just above her knee, revealing shapely calves and firm, smooth skin. So Gwen was childishly pleased to see the grin falter on Jack's face as he held it just too long without getting any sort of encouraging response from Betty.
"Okay," said Jack firmly. "No readings above the sort of background radiation there would be if Wildman had visited the apartment. Nothing to suggest the fuel packs are in here. So someone elsewhere in Cardiff could be getting a really big dose of radiation. Get on to Tosh and see if she's got any way of detecting that." He indicated the bathroom door. "One more room to check." Gwen smiled at Betty and hunkered back down next to her to continue their conversation. She got no further
because just as she was about to inquire further about Wildman, she was interrupted by a yell from Jack. Gwen bounced back to her feet and rushed into the bathroom after Jack. He was struggling with a long beige towel that he'd got draped over his arm, but she knew that people didn't wrestle with wet towels. It was the limb of some monstrous creature in the bathtub. There was no visible head or torso. The thing looked like it was just a collection of long, coarse-skinned arms emerging from the water in the bath. Two of them stretched up across the off-white tiles opposite and made a soft popping sound as their suckers detached and reattached themselves to the smooth surface of the wall and shower screen. The other two draped over the edge of the tub, a meter long apiece. Gwen steadied herself on the linoleum, which was soaked in water that had splashed over the edge of the bath. The nearest of the monster's limbs had seized Jack's right forearm. It was wrapped firmly around the sleeve of his greatcoat and was dragging him, skidding him across the floor. He must have struggled to draw his revolver with his left hand because it was lying in a pool of water beside the bath panel. Gwen drew her weapon. She stepped sideways to avoid Jack's back, straddled the toilet bowl to place her feet firmly, and held the pistol steadily in a two-handed grip. Took a deep breath, released it slowly, and while she exhaled, squeezed the trigger gently but firmly. Four shots in swift succession, deafeningly loud in the tiny bathroom, four shots into the creature that writhed in the bathwater, four shots that barely made it twitch. Just above the edge of the bath now, she could see where the limbs joined the creature's body. Underneath it, a dark hole was opening up, and a tube began to extrude itself like some ghastly proboscis. It was its mouth. Jack tried to throw himself away from the creature, using the strength of his upper body to propel himself violently sideways. He smashed brutally into a flimsy bathroom cabinet on the wall. The mirror shattered, and the chipboard carcass disintegrated and disgorged its contents on top of Jack as he slumped to the floor. Shampoo bottles, a packet of razors, several boxes of plasters and paracetamol struck his shoulder, and two bottles of aftershave rolled off his back. Gwen seized a bottle of pink aftershave. The revolting tentacle had now writhed its way twice around Jack's sleeve. Gwen twisted the cap off the aftershave and tipped up the bottle so that the astringent pink liquid glugged out onto the bizarre starfish's limb. The coarse skin bubbled and fizzed, but the tentacle did not withdraw. It didn't even flinch. "Stop!" Jack yelled. She pointed. "It's starting to burn through it! Unless you get another 20 bottles, it ain't gonna make a heap of difference!" Gwen stared desperately around the room. She scrambled over the toilet and back out through the door to the lounge area. Betty was still sitting in the armchair, staring towards the bathroom with a curious, strangely calm air about her. Gwen could understand that she might be in shock. She shrieked at Betty, "Get out of here now!" The blonde woman didn't need any more encouragement. She struggled up out of the armchair, pulled her coat around herself, and fled through the hallway and out of the apartment. Gwen shoved the armchair savagely to one side. She ran to the socket by the TV to ensure it was switched on. She seized the two-bar fire, flicked it on, and raced back towards the bathroom. Jack was now lying lengthways on the bathroom floor, parallel to the bath. His right arm was almost engulfed by the tentacle. Worse still, the second nearest limb was starting to slide out of the bath towards his leg. Gwen clambered up onto the toilet seat, hefted the fire above her head, and lobbed it over Jack and into the center of the bath. Immediately, the room was illuminated by a huge flash. Blue-white sparks arced over the surface of the water. The creature didn't make a sound, but its three unattached limbs flailed and thrashed. They slapped repeatedly against the wall tiles and cracked the shower screen from top to bottom. Water slopped over the edge of the bath and onto the linoleum. The tentacle that had wound its way around Jack's arm whipped away with a slurping sound as the suckers detached themselves. Jack sat up abruptly. "Don't touch the water!" Gwen yelled at him, and he held his hands high above his head in acknowledgement. He was able to shuffle out of the room and into the living area. After a few seconds, the blue sparks disappeared and the starfish ceased its thrashing motion. The limbs slid lifelessly down the wall, and the entire creature slid under what remained of the water in the bath. "Power's off!" Jack shouted from the other room. Gwen slumped in relief. She stepped down from the toilet and picked her way carefully out of the drenched bathroom. "What the hell is it?" His expression confirmed that he was as baffled as her. "Sure looked like the daddy of whatever Wildman puked, didn't it? And what was the deal with that aftershave? He'd get luckier if he wiped his face with... Ow!"
Jack started shrugging his greatcoat off.
Ow! Ah!
He continued to struggle with the coat. Once he had shucked it onto the floor, he hurried back to the bathroom, still yelling in pain. He pulled off his sleeveless jacket and slipped his braces off his shoulders. He wrenched his shirt off, plunged his right arm into the wash basin, and spun the top of the cold tap around with his left hand. He sluiced down his right arm, rubbing at his flesh with a towel that he'd seized from the nearby rail. Gwen picked up the blue cotton shirt from where Jack had thrown it. "Careful," he warned her. The thing was digesting it. Jack finished patting his skin with the towel. He snatched a second one from the rail, soaked it in fresh water, and carefully wound it around his forearm. Then he turned to face Gwen.
"God," she said, "that really is a horrible smell."
In the aftermath of her rescue, Gwen had not looked again at the creature. Now she could see that the thing had shriveled up in the bath. It looked like a gray, pulpy mass, slowly disintegrating and clouding the water. Under the shower, there were three empty tins of dog food and a can opener. A small metal watering can was propped at the other end of the bath, as though abandoned. "I usually like fried fish," sniffed Jack from behind her. "Get me some vinegar and a fork. We can do a taste test." Gwen pointed into the bath. In the scum forming on the water's surface, she could make out silver slivers of plant spikes. No point in Betty feeding his plants. He was feeding them to the starfish. That and a regular diet of pedigree chum. Jack had slipped his jacket back on now and was examining the arm of his greatcoat. It was secreting digestive juices that can dissolve organic matter. "It's eaten through my sleeves. Look." There was a large patch in the forearm of his coat, and when she checked, Gwen found a smaller matching hole in his shirt. "Pure cotton," sighed Jack. "I'm never going to get a replacement shirt that good." He winced again. Gwen helped him unpeel the towel from around his arm. There was a raw red patch, an irregular circle about 5 centimeters across, oozing blood. "These flesh wounds sting like hell, but they heal up if I leave them uncovered. Made the mistake of putting a shirt back on over a knife wound once, and had to have the material cut out again. That was hard to explain to the nurse in triage." The smell of burnt flesh was less noticeable in the living room. The apartment was eerily quiet, with only the patter of rain against the window to break the silence. "Betty's safely out of the way," observed Jack. "Better get this place sealed until Owen can get across here to examine that starfish corpse. Let's give the local cops a call. Have them post a guy on the front door." Gwen made the call to the local police. Like all Torchwood mobiles, hers had a direct line. It connected them immediately to the major crime investigation team, whether the police wanted it or not. Torchwood not only had the technology to break into the police systems, but it was smart enough to accommodate the hierarchy and the standard admin procedures of incident teams. There was the right balance to strike between the need to get officers involved at all and the need to avoid getting the police crawling all over something they could not properly handle. "Okay," she explained to Jack. "They have officers on the way, just in case Betty gets enough courage to come back to water the plants again." They stepped out onto the apartment's landing. Jack pulled the front door shut, and they started down the stairs. The rain had got even heavier outside. Gwen buttoned her jacket, and Jack pulled his damaged coat over his shoulders like a cloak. They hurried back down the side road, the only people on foot in the whole area. Jack took the driver's seat this time. Gwen's mobile was ringing as they climbed into the SUV. She slotted it into the speaker attachment by the passenger seat. Toshiko's calm voice filled the car. "Do you fancy a drive out into the countryside? In this weather? What could be nicer? Why?" "Because I got an interesting match on that artifact, Jack. The thing in Wildman's neck matches one found in the corpse of a soldier at the Carrigan Barracks. Sergeant Anthony B. He was shot dead in an attempted armed robbery recently at the barracks itself. I was just going out there to interview the senior officer." "Okay. Taking Owen, too?" "He'll have to stay here, still decontaminating. We'll meet you at Carrigan. Tosh, thanks." Jack moved to disconnect the phone, but Gwen reached out and put her hand on his arm. "Hang on a moment, Jack. I'd like to check on Betty Jenkins. Let her know that the police are on their way and to stay away from Wildman's apartment." She spoke slightly louder so Toshiko would hear. "Tosh,
Can you tell me which apartment in this block Betty Jenkins is in? Hang on.
They waited, imagining Toshiko initiating a search on her computer.
There you go. I'm sending it through to you now.
The display screen in front of Jack flickered into life. It showed a schematic of the apartment block with one of the apartments picked out in red. Elizabeth Mary Jenkins, flat number 4.
See you at the barracks, Tosh, said Jack.
Thanks. He disconnected the phone and handed it back to Gwen. I should drive you round to the apartment block. No point in you running through the streets in the rain again. He started the engine and steered off into the rain. The SUV's lights flared on the wet roadway.
How is it you get to check up on the good-looking blonde with the legs all the way up to her ears?
You're not her type, Gwen admonished him as the car drew up by the apartment block. I'll see you back down here. On the first landing, Gwen rapped the brass door knocker of number 4. There was a long pause, so she rapped again more firmly.
All right, said a petulant voice on the other side. Keep your hair on!
The door opened a crack, and a wrinkled face peered out past the security chain.
Is Miss Jenkins in?
Gwen was aware that she'd inadvertently raised her voice.
I'm Miss Jenkins, and I'm not deaf.
No, I mean Betty Jenkins. Gwen offered the old woman her most winning smile, the one she used to try out on suspicious witnesses during door-to-door inquiries. The old woman breathed out sharply in irritation.
I told you, I'm Betty Jenkins, Miss Betty Jenkins. Who are you?
It was apparent that this was the real Betty Jenkins, not a scared mid-30s blonde, but a somewhat scary spinster in her mid-80s determined to guard her privacy.
I'm sorry, said Gwen. She took a step back from the door to reassure the woman.
Sorry to have disturbed you, Miss Jenkins.
I should think so, said the old lady, closing the door.
The SUV's engine was still running. Jack was drumming his fingers on the steering wheel when Gwen got back into the passenger seat.
How's a good-looking blonde?
The experience has aged her. Gwen told him about the real Betty Jenkins in flat 4.
Should have noticed, she concluded. Strange that she wore that big coat while she was in Wildman's flat. If she lived in the flat downstairs, why would she put a coat on to go water his plants?
Because she doesn't live downstairs, agreed Jack. Any chance we can trace where she went?
Not a chance. Streets are empty in this rain.
House to house would be a long shot, on the off chance anyone saw which way she went. And that'll only give us a general direction. No CCTV round here, so she's impossible to track.
All right. Jack had reached a firm decision. He revved the engine. Let's go with what we know. Carrigan Barracks. He slammed the SUV into gear, swerved it around the street, and put his foot down.
Owen wriggled lower in his chair, frustrated. His jaw clenched and the tension rose in his neck and shoulders. He got up from his terminal and had a big stretch. He could see lights on in the boardroom where Toshiko had been working earlier. She had phoned up to him a couple of times, and he'd abruptly told her to leave him alone. He examined the Geiger counter now and saw the reading had improved but was still too high. His contemplation was interrupted by the sound of his mobile phone. The display told him, unknown caller, and a phone number he didn't recognize. There was a notice affixed to the wall outside the base commander's office. It detailed, in brief, the expectations of soldiers at the barracks. The list started with selfless commitment, to put others before you, went through courage, discipline, integrity, and loyalty, and concluded with respect for others, to treat others with decency at all times. After 5 minutes with Lieutenant Colonel Daniel York, Gwen wanted to drag him from his own office and press his nose up against the notice so that he could read the last one. York's territorial hackles had already been raised by the authority that Torchwood assumed. But his mood had soured further when he learned that this Torchwood delegation was run by a captain from the RAF, someone he would conventionally outrank. British armies held in the highest regard all around the world. Respect that was hard won over recent years. Northern Ireland, Falklands, Bosnia, Kosovo, the Gulf, obviously, and countless peacekeeping ops throughout the world.
Yes, sir, Jack said as York took a rare pause to draw breath.
We appreciate that. Our professionalism in the British Army doesn't come through chance. We attain it by constant, thorough, and tough training.
They are the best.
York seemed to be addressing his comments now to the two soldier escorts who stood at the back of the room.
And the best are taught by the best.
So no need to have dragged your team all the way out here, Captain Harkness. We can conclude this investigation ourselves.
Was Sergeant Antony B one of the best?
Jack said. York's fluent lecture stumbled to a halt. I really cannot comment at this stage of the investigation, he said eventually. He stopped looking out of the window. Jack certainly had his attention now. He scattered 6 photographs carelessly onto the Lieutenant Colonel's desk. Recent brutal murders from the center of Cardiff. Do they look familiar? York gave the photos a cursory examination without touching them.
You can't expect me to believe that these vagrants have any connection to Kerrigan.
Jack shoved the photographs across the desk, closer to York.
Not the people. Their wounds.
York considered the evidence briefly before pushing it slowly back across the desk.
That's something you need to ask Dr. Death.
You're kidding me, right? The M.O. He's Dr. Robert Death. It's a joke. York forced his thin lips into a tight, mirthless smile in an attempt to illustrate this.
I'm sure Gwen will bear that in mind, he turned and said to her.
You can start with the medical officer while Tosh and I finish up here. York stood up, annoyed that Gwen was already moving towards the door.
I didn't request any help from Torchwood, Captain.
Jack sat down in the chair opposite him. Lieutenant Colonel, I don't remember saying we were here to help you.
Major Robert Diath was a complete contrast to York, and almost too eager to please.
He took one look at Gwen as she entered his office and immediately asked her, in his soft Scots accent, to take a seat while he found her a towel to dry her hair. He then offered her a cup of coffee, apologizing because he'd just run out of milk, so it would have to be black. And would that be all right with her?
I need to know about Sergeant Antony B., Gwen said.
Diath settled into his own chair and placed his hands on his knees.
Terrible business.
Tell me more. Diath looked up at the ceiling, as though he was visualizing something. Antony was a PT instructor here, well-respected, admired by the men. Some of the officers suspected that he was too familiar with the other soldiers.
In what way?
Diath paused. Having a drink with them at the Feathers, he said cagily, that sort of thing. Not the sort of fraternization York really approves of. I can imagine. Did you disapprove?
Diath smiled at her. Soldiers don't just come to me for straightforward medical problems. They can turn to the MO for advice and counseling, too. I think the best MOs are those who join in with the life of the community they serve. Sports, social.
You do a better job if you understand the daily routines of the soldiers in your care.
Did B come to you for counseling?
Diath gave her a mock frown. I'm sure you know I couldn't tell you if he had, but I can tell you that what led to his death was utterly out of character for him.
He could see her expression encouraging him to continue.
Sergeant B was shot dead while trying to steal an amphibious vehicle loaded with tools. I was also told earlier today that he had previously been suspected of stealing a Jeep and some scuba equipment while supposedly on leave. So the authorities here kept an eye out for when he returned from his leave. They identified him as soon as he had signed back into camp, and then tried to arrest him. He was shot dead while resisting arrest and threatening the sentries with a handgun.
No prior indication of this?
None, said Diath. With anyone else, you'd suspect some extraordinary change in his personal circumstances or medical history. But this was like some psychotic episode. His voice trailed off in puzzlement.
You know, Sergeant B said a bizarre thing just before they shot him.
Bizarre is my strong suit, said Gwen.
What was it?
The major shook his head, puzzled.
He said, see you again soon.
No one understands what he meant. But then, no one understands why he did what he did. The people he killed.
He put his face in his hands. It was as though he was trying to hide from something.
Gwen just sat quietly, waiting for him to compose himself. York briefed me ahead of your arrival, admitted Diath. He told me you Torchwood people always take the extreme view. We have a saying in basic training. If you hear hoofbeats, you look for horses, not zebras.
You don't know the half of it, Gwen said. In my job, if I hear hoofbeats, I expect to see unicorns.
I'm starting to understand that now. Diath took in a deep breath and exhaled it slowly.
What B said, though, that wasn't the only strange thing. We've had two other deaths here recently, two more young soldiers. They had savage injuries to the backs of their necks. At first we thought they were animal wounds.
But the tooth marks were clearly human, Gwen continued. And from your post-mortem on Sergeant B, you concluded it was him that had bitten them, murdered them.
We've told no one. We hardly know how to describe what happened, never mind anything else.
How can you possibly know about it?
Gwen smiled apologetically.
Bizarre is my strong suit.
It was surprising how long Jack had managed to keep his temper, reflected Toshiko. The lieutenant colonel had been unable to get him even to raise his voice, despite his continued evasions and obstructions. Jack had just nodded a curt agreement when told that he and Toshiko would be accompanied around the barracks at all times by an armed guard. Faced with a walk across the parade ground in the pelting rain, Jack had merely rolled his eyes, pulled up his collar, and stalked off at a brisk pace. Private Foxton, their escort, ushered them into one of the sleeping blocks and firmly pulled the outer door closed. Apart from the three of them, the building was empty and silent, which made the contrast with the hiss of rain outside all the more marked. This is the single living accommodation, Foxton explained. Trainees plus some of the staff.
Toshiko had imagined the place would be set out as two rows of beds in a barn-like space, with a sergeant major pacing between them while squatties in vests stood to ramrod attention beside their neatly folded gray blankets. Instead, there was a series of smaller rooms containing no more than four beds each, sometimes only two. Each was tidy and organized, though with none of the formality of an old-fashioned barracks.
Where's Sergeant B's room?
Private Foxton showed them to the end of another corridor. As an instructor, Sergeant B had a single room. I think the door may be locked. Jack stepped back, raised his right leg, and kicked out savagely just above the handle. The door crashed open, taking a splintered chunk of the lintel with it.
Toshiko followed him into the room.
You could have tried the handle first.
Inside was a compact square space. Set into the far wall was a window behind half-closed curtains. Toshiko made her way across to open them fully. Grayish-white light filtered into the room through a screen of rainwater. Drawing the thin blue material back revealed a radiator beneath the sill and, in the corner, a freestanding basin on a metal frame. The bed was stripped bare, revealing a mottled mattress on which fresh blankets and sheets had been piled. Presumably, these had been delivered to B's room for his return from leave. A plain, bare desk stood against one wall. Beside the desk was piled three stout cardboard boxes, one much larger than the others.
Looks like the door wasn't locked, said Foxen. It was an observation, not a reproof. The soldiers seemed unfazed by Jack's violent method of entry.
Toshiko indicated the boxes by the desk. He was all packed and ready to go.
No, explained Foxen. We packed those up to make space for when the new instructor moves in. Tomorrow, I think. You don't waste much time around here, do you? Jack flipped open the top of another box.
Door unlocked, no guard on the premises, new guy practically installed. It's like B was never here.
The largest box contained a mesh duffel bag, black with red details and the word Edge printed on the side. It was almost empty.
Toshiko pulled out three items. She found a yellow and white snorkel with reflective tape at the surface end. Beside that was a camera. The third thing was a squarish, zippered bag that contained a circular black and silver device that Toshiko did not recognize.
It's a diving regulator, explained Foxton. He loved to take pictures of the fish.
Jack had found a shoebox filled with glossy prints. Jack started to spread them out on the desk. They had not been sorted, so out-of-focus shots were mixed with other clearer pictures of exotically colored marine life. Some included divers, anonymous in their dive masks, exploring underwater.
No pictures of his family.
Didn't have any immediate family, Foxen said. No next of kin. But he went on dives with a regular group of friends.
Jack slid one of the photographs across the desk so that it was in front of Toshiko.
Recognize this guy?
It's Guy Wildman.
"Have you been making a mess?" said a voice from the door. Toshiko looked up to see Gwen coming in, accompanied by her escort. Private Foxton had jumped into a more alert mode as he heard Gwen arriving. He now relaxed a little and nodded a greeting to the other soldier. Toshiko passed some of the glossy photos to Gwen. "We made a connection with Wildman. There were underwater photos at his apartment, not to mention some wildlife in his bathroom. Gwen was rummaging in her pocket and brought out a small Geiger counter. She switched it on, and it clicked reassuringly at the lowest end of the scale. Here's another of the three divers," noted Jack. Gwen and Toshiko looked at the photo he had held out. A trio of divers on a boat, ready to drop into the blue water behind them, their thumbs raised. "We saw that picture at Wildman's apartment," agreed Gwen. "Wildman, B, and another one," mused Toshiko. "And this could be the third. She's quite a looker." "That's one of the instructors," said Private Foxton. "Sergeant Applegate. She was another sub-aqua enthusiast." As soon as she saw the photograph, Gwen's expression had hardened. She twisted the photograph so Jack could see it more clearly. "It's the woman who claimed to be Betty Jenkins." Jack leaped from the table and made for the door. He paused in the shattered doorframe and snapped a question at Foxton. "Where is this Sergeant Applegate? We need to see her now." Foxton looked flustered for the first time. I don't know, sir. She's been absent without leave for 3 weeks." Jack screwed up his eyes tight and slammed at the door with his clenched fist. "I wish I had time to go and slap the lieutenant colonel in his stiff upper lip. He knew this and told us nothing. It's obstruction, pure and simple." "It's trust," Gwen told him quietly. "It's not right, but it's understandable." No time for polite conversation, Jack decided. "Well, we know Applegate wasn't at Wildman's flat to feed his plants." "Unless she was feeding them to that thing in the bath," Gwen agreed. Toshiko saw that Jack was picking slivers of wood from a cut in the side of his hand. He had slammed his fist into the broken section of the door and caught a bunch of splinters. "Maybe you were right, Tosh. I should have used the handle." "Not locked," she agreed. "No guard." Jack stared at her, astounded. "No guard!" he yelled. "That's right. But there was a guard at Wildman's apartment. Wasn't there, Gwen?"
"Applegate?"
"No, the thing in the bathroom. We know that Wildman could puke up those things. He must have barfed one into the tub to guard whatever he'd hidden there. Come on, we gotta get back. Whatever it was guarding, it could still be there." The rain squalled around them during their sprint across the barracks, so the front of their clothing was swiftly soaked. They reached the visitor's car park, skittering to a halt in the puddles by their vehicles. Jack slipped into the SUV driving seat and started the engine. Gwen tossed her Saab keys back to Toshiko. She knew what to expect back at Wildman's apartment and planned to travel back there with Jack. The SUV slewed backwards across the rain-soaked gravel of the car park, crunched into gear, and skidded forward, off out of the barracks. The front wipers swished on a fast setting, and through the windscreen ahead of them, Gwen could see the bruised black sky that lowered over their destination, a huge swath of boiling cloud that was turning the afternoon dark. Jack punched the phone speed dial, and it connected with a rapid series of beeps. "How's it going, Owen?" The line was distorted, and Gwen thought Owen said, "What do you care?" "Sounds like the storm's wiping out the phone network, too," Jack said. "So listen up. Are you still irradiated, Owen?" "Yeah, I'm lit up like a novelty lamp." "Okay, well, you can still make yourself useful. Need to do a search on Sergeant Sandra Applegate, training instructor at Carrigan Barracks, Southern Welsh Regiment. Lives at the barracks, but spends time on scuba diving activities off of it. Find out known associates. We already connect her with Wildman and B, so skip those. She ain't gonna be visiting them much now. So who else? Where she hangs out, you know the score." There was a pause in which Gwen thought she could make out swearing. "Can't Tosh do that?" Owen moaned. "Not while she's driving the other car," explained Jack. "I thought she had hands free." "What were you planning to do in the meantime, Owen? Get on with it."
By the time they arrived back in Cardiff, thick dark clouds had blotted out every scrap of sky. The drainage system in the center had collapsed, and the SUV had to surf a filthy stream of debris that washed down the angled streets that led into Splott. Jack pulled the car up outside the apartment block, with the wheels propped up on the pavement to get them out of the torrent that coursed along the gutter. A flare of lights from behind them showed that Toshiko had arrived too. Gwen scrambled over the driver's seat to follow Jack out and avoid the stream that was running along the road on her side of the vehicle. When she'd clambered out and shut the door, she found Jack stooped over something by the main entrance. Toshiko was standing beside him, her face pallid after seeing what Jack had found. It was the police officer who had been stationed by the doorway. The body lay in a stream of water that spilled from a broken gutter far above. Gwen could tell he was dead from the crazy angle of his neck. She clicked on her pocket torch and examined the body. Something had ripped into the back of the young officer's neck, or rather, someone had. Brain and bone was visible in the maw of the wound, washed clean continuously by the downpour. There was very little blood visible, and it was even washing out of the young lad's shirt collar. He lay crumpled in the shrubs, a young lad, Gwen thought bitterly. The three of them haired up the stairs, several at a time. On the upper landing, the real Betty Jenkins was poking her head out from behind her door with an angry look. Toshiko ushered her back into her apartment and told her to keep her door closed while the environmental health team conducted a fumigation of the stairwell. On the next landing, they found the sprawled body of another policeman. There was no rain to wash away the blood. It had spurted out of a main artery in his neck, spraying up the nearest wall before running down and creating a congealed pool of dark reddish-brown liquid. Wildman's apartment door stood ajar. Gwen rose from examining the dead policeman and hesitated. "Come on," hissed Jack. He drew his Webley, kicked open the front door, and angled his weapon into the hallway. The way seemed clear, so Toshiko charged in, her weapon at the ready. She was barely into the main room when Sandra Applegate sprang at her from beyond the living room door. Applegate knocked Toshiko to the floor and loomed over her. Even from the front entrance, Gwen could see Applegate was a mess. Her face was bloodied and her chest was stained. Jack threw himself down the short hallway with thundering steps and cuffed Applegate behind the head with the butt of his revolver. Applegate spun away into the room, tipping over a table and collapsing by an armchair. Gwen rushed in and covered the fallen woman with her gun. In the corner of her eye, she could see that Toshiko had fallen awkwardly against the sideboard and was slumped against the wall. Jack hunkered down next to her, checking that she was all right. And for a moment, Gwen was distracted. Applegate was on her feet at once, charging for the door. She shouldered Jack aside, surprising him so that she was able to get past. He recovered swiftly, stepped briskly into the hallway after her, and loosed off two shots in quick succession. Gwen thought she heard a cry, and then a great crash of glass. Jack rushed back into the room. Toshiko was dazed, but not injured. Jack helped her back to her feet and beckoned to Toshiko and Gwen to follow him out of the apartment. Out on the landing, rain was washing in through a fresh hole in the half-landing window. I shot her, upper arm. She was running down the stairs, so the momentum carried her on and through that window. He trotted down the half-flight of steps. He considered the rain and wind gusting in through the hole before twisting the latch and opening the shattered remains of the window. He took a swift look through the gap, pulled his head back in. "I can't see the body," he said. "Come on, two floors down, who's going to survive that?" He studied Toshiko and Gwen's reactions. "Okay, we should check on the way out." They returned to the apartment and went into the bathroom. The remains of the starfish had dissolved into a slimy gloop in the bath. Gwen didn't argue when Jack said he would conduct the search. Hidden behind the side panel of the bath, he found a heavy gray box. He pulled it onto the bathroom rug and slid it across the room. Gwen switched on her Geiger counter, which ticked quietly. Jack lifted the lid of the box, and the ticking abruptly became a machine gun rattle of alarm. Jack snapped the lid shut. "Okay," he said calmly. "We appear to have the missing fuel rods." They had to make two journeys down the stairwell. On the first, they carried the lead-lined box and pushed it into the boot of the SUV. Second time, they wrapped up the policeman's corpse in a blanket from Wildman's apartment and hefted the body down the stairs. By the time they'd put the other copper's body in the boot,
All three of them were drenched in what felt to Gwen like equal measures of sweat and rainwater. Jack slammed the boot closed. "You two go back to the hub and get changed. Take the sob. I'll deliver the fuel rods to Blyde Droog and join you later." He closed the door and steered the SUV upstream and out of the street. Yanto found it surprisingly difficult to close the front door. There was a gale blowing straight across the bay, and that meant straight at the entrance to the hub from Mermaid Key. He put his shoulder to the edge nearest the frame, and after a bit more effort, he was able to get the door to click into place. Jack had breezed in, but so had several gallons of water, and the reception floor was awash. "We're going to need some sandbags out there, Yanto, if this rain keeps up." "Yeah, the neighborhood's gone to pot," said Yanto. "Maybe we should move." "I don't think so," said Jack. "Imagine how many tea chests we'd need to pack." He shook himself like a wet dog, and rainwater splattered across the room. His trousers were soaked up to the knee, and he decided it would be a good idea to grasp the material and squeeze water out of the legs right there and then. Yanto helped Jack out of his wet coat. "You've got a big hole in your sleeve," he said. "Nothing escapes your eagle eye." Jack shucked off his sopping wet shoes and proceeded to peel off his socks and wring them out into the waste bin. "Are Tosh and Gwen back?" "Waiting for you downstairs," said Yanto. "You're not wearing any socks," Gwen told him. "Nothing escapes your eagle eye," replied Jack. "Owen around?" "I think Yanto knows where he is," said Gwen. Toshiko tapped the display screen to get their attention. "We're supposed to have 36 inches of rain a year, and we've had 24 inches in as many hours." "The oval basin is starting to fill up with water," agreed Gwen. "It was like a river raging through there when we walked back from the car." Toshiko showed a few more graphics on the display. They did a lot of groundwater modeling studies when they were proposing the barrage for the bay. "I'm going to tap into their instrumentation. They've got over 200 boreholes recording groundwater levels every 30 minutes, persisted Toshiko. "And they measure other environmental parameters like rainfall, obviously, and atmospheric pressure. That lot should give us some idea of what's going on." Yanto came into the room to offer them coffee. He looked disapprovingly at Jack's bare feet, so Jack removed them from the table. "Okay, let's have your program run overnight, Tosh, and see what it tells us tomorrow. Go home now. It's late." "You too, Gwen." Gwen knew better than to protest. She heaved herself out of her chair and made her way to the exit platform with Toshiko. Jack watched Yanto polish the table where his feet had been propped. "Gwen tells me you know where Owen is." Yanto stopped polishing. "No. His radiation readings reached normal, so he decided to go out. On a date," he said. "A date? What about the work I asked him to do?" Yanto produced a folder of printouts. "He asked me to give you these. He said that there's a lot of information about what a brave and resourceful soldier Sergeant Applegate is. Fine service record." Jack flipped open the folder and stood up. "I'm going to take this down to my office." They both walked out of the boardroom and made their way down the spiral staircase to the main hub. The glare from the streetlights cast a jaundiced pall across the sodden T-junction. Owen sat listening to the howl of the wind and the battering percussion of rain above the Boxster. The storm outside buffeted the car, and rain lashed the windscreen until it was awash. Owen flicked on the wipers. They swiped the water aside so that he could peer through the glass at Megan's place across the road. He'd sat here for 10 minutes already, kidding himself that he was just waiting for the rainstorm to ease off, just rehearsing what he was going to say, devising the best and most logical explanation for Megan. In reality, he felt like he was a student again. The first time he'd arranged to meet her. Then he stood outside the Angus halls of residence, uncertain, nervous. He leaned back against the head restraint and looked around the rest of the Porsche. Under his coat, the passenger seat had 3 old crisp packets on it, one only half finished. He slipped off his seatbelt to look in the footwell, where he found bits of gravel plus a couple of forgotten AA batteries, probably dead, but he stuffed them in his jacket pocket just in case. He was experimenting with doing the same with the crisp packets when he thought, "That's just stupid. He's arranged to see her for the first time in over 5 years, and he's bringing her a pocketful of empty crisp packets. He should have stopped off to get her flowers. Roses. She liked roses, didn't she? Or a bottle of wine, at least." Owen unlocked the glove compartment. The light flicked on,
and he could see the dull sheen of the Becquerin tool. That was a better idea. Never mind the wine and roses. The alien device felt cool in his palm as he slipped it into his jacket pocket. He hadn't changed before leaving the hub, because that would have delayed him getting to Megan. So it seemed daft to sit here, just peering up at her room. He wasn't that uncertain undergraduate now. He hadn't been the awkward kid anymore when he and Megan had split up, when he'd left her. He struggled into his coat, determined not to get out of the car before putting it on because he knew he'd be drenched within seconds. The maisonette was 30 meters away. Owen popped the car door, levered himself out, double-locked the Boxster with a flick of his wrist, then scurried over to the L-shaped steps. At the top, he pressed the doorbell. The door opened, light spilled out all around him, and Megan stood in the doorway studying him, appraising him. Owen looked at her for a few seconds that lasted forever. "Are you going to invite me in?" he asked. Megan stepped aside and held the door open. "What are you, some kind of vampire?" She beckoned him in. Megan told him to remove his wet shoes, and when she saw his socks, those too. She peeled off his sopping coat to drape on a wall-hanging peg before making him stand barefoot on the cold linoleum while she went to fetch him something to dry his hair. He watched her disappear through the nearest doorway. Megan was still as slim as he remembered. Her voice echoed from the bathroom, telling him how he would have to take her as he found her, and that she'd barely had time to tidy up her paperwork, let alone run a Hoover around the place. Owen closed his eyes and imagined himself back in their Balham flat, calling from one side to the other as they caught up on the events of their day at the university. When he opened them again, she was waggling a towel at him. "Cleanest one I've got, I'm afraid." She watched him towel his hair for a bit. "I'll put on the kettle now you're here. Go on through." She waved in the opposite direction as she disappeared into an unseen kitchen on the right. Owen stepped into the room. The lounge diner was evidently the largest room in the maisonette, but felt cramped because of the amount of stuff crammed into it. He could smell the remains of a Chinese meal, not quite disguised by floral air freshener. Two Art Deco lamps on opposite walls cast a warm glow across the room. On the outer wall, pushed up near the window, a gate-like dining table was unfolded and covered with a cream tablecloth. Four fabric-covered chairs, blue with no arms, were pressed up against three sides. The rest of the room was dominated by a battered leather sofa that dwarfed a tiny glass-topped wicker coffee table, and a crumpled green armchair so huge that he couldn't work out how it could originally have been brought into the room. He saw his own reflection wrinkling his nose in an octagonal mirror above the sofa. He dropped into the green armchair and faced the TV, and he wondered if it was Megan's regular seat. So he got up again and flicked through a nearby magazine rack. "Can't tell if you live here on your own or not," he added in his normal voice. "Mind your own bloody business," Megan retorted mildly. While he'd been looking at the magazines, she had walked into the room behind him. She carried a circular tray that held an open bottle and two large wine glasses. The ribbed cream top she wore accentuated her slender arms and the roundness of her breasts. He pretended to look at her hair instead. "You've cut it a lot shorter. Than I remember, I mean. Easier for A&E. Do sit down, Owen. I don't charge people to use the furniture." He perched on the sofa. The leather cushion creaked. Megan set the tray down on the table. She glugged out half a glass for him. "More. Chateau Lafleur Chambeau, 2004. French. Well done, Clouseau. Have you educated your palate since we..." She paused, awkwardly. Poured herself a glass and then breathed in the aroma. "Are you more discriminating, or am I wasting this very fine bottle on you?" Owen smiled and chinked his glass against hers. Megan swirled the wine around her glass and inhaled the aroma. "Don't think I haven't noticed that you came empty-handed tonight." She narrowed her eyes and studied him a bit more closely. "Are those biscuit crumbs on your jacket sleeve? In fact, have you made any kind of effort this evening to..." Her voice trailed off as she saw something else. "Is that a gun in your pocket, Owen?" Owen shifted awkwardly on the sofa, straightened his jacket and trousers. "Yes, I'm afraid it is." Megan looked like she couldn't decide whether to get up or to remain seated. She fidgeted with her glass.
She set it down on the glass tabletop, changed her mind and transferred it to the tray, twisted her necklace between her long pale fingers. "Oh," she said eventually. Owen listened to the sound of the rain battering the window for a while, thinking how best to go on. "I work for Torchwood," he began. The second glass was better than the first, Owen decided. He'd helped himself, if only to punctuate his explanation with a pause to do something else. Megan had slowly relaxed into the sofa, bringing her legs up onto the cushion and cradling her glass lightly in both hands. He tried to decipher her expression, just as he had when they'd lived together. In Balaam, decoding her unspoken mood had been a different matter, the consequences less significant. In their kitchen, as they cooked, could he escape some chore? In their bedroom, was she expecting him to have noticed a change she'd made to the flat, her clothes, her hair? After making love, was she trying not to blurt out again that she loved him? He watched her face for the familiar clues that he'd barely forgotten over the years. She couldn't quite hold his gaze, affecting to study his jacket, or picking at crumbs on his trouser leg. Finally, she said in a quiet, faintly mocking voice, "So, you're the space police?" "Police?" Owen snorted, and immediately regretted the dismissive sound he'd made. "I mean, all that process and procedure and paperwork just get in the way." "So you're outside the law?" "No, not that either. We're tangential to it." He rubbed pensively at his forehead. "Thing is, Megan, I think you'd be interested in Torchwood. I think you'd be right for us." Megan was scratching idly at another crumb on his knee, so he grasped her hand. "I know you would." "Is that the wine talking?" "It's my instinct talking." Megan sat up straight, her eyes alive with anger. "Oh, where have I heard that before? No, don't interrupt me. Don't you dare interrupt." She wasn't having any difficulty meeting his gaze now. "It was your instinct that you couldn't stay in London, wasn't it? It was your instinct that you couldn't be cooped up or tied down." He remembered. He hadn't known what he wanted back then. He'd only known what he didn't want. The weekly shop at Tesco, the visits to her sister in Penarth, the trips to Croydon and IKEA to buy furniture for the flat, stuff that might do until they got a bigger place together, she said. Flat-pack furniture he could bear, just about. But he hadn't been ready for a follow-the-leaflet life with Megan. He'd escaped by making a feeble excuse because he could. He was able to walk away from it, away from her. And he hadn't looked back as he left to see how much she was going to miss him. "Your instinct was a lot of good for us, wasn't it?" Megan concluded more quietly. "I thought you were joking when you first talked about how you'd always wanted to travel, remember? You'd met a Kiwi at a gig in Battersea. That girl Esther you said you were obsessed by, and oh no, you said, she was just so different, so fascinating, and we discussed whether New Zealand was as far away as you could get." Owen smiled. "Australia. We were in Hyde Park and it was pissing down and we decided that you couldn't get further away than Australia. You might as well have been in Australia after we split up, after you left." "I didn't think you'd want a postcard," he replied. No, that sounded too hard, too dismissive. "It was all bullshit, you're right. I didn't get as far as Sydney. Not much further than Sidcup, come to think of it." "Sidcup? So much for, I want to be the real me. Owen, remember? That was your excuse for running away. I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean to upset you." "Just now?" she asked. "Or back in Balaam?" "I want you to join us in Torchwood." Her face was blank now. Or wary at best. "It's a hell of a lot more fun than the A&E. Megan stared right into his eyes, like she'd made a decision. "Come on. I'm sitting here not sure whether to throw you out or call a psychiatrist." "So why aren't you throwing me out then?" he insisted. "Right now. Why aren't you making some excuse about how you're due back on shift, or you have to feed the neighbor's cat? My shift does start soon. About an hour and a half." Owen leaned closer to her. "And here I am, still. Why? What suddenly started to make sense?" Megan pulled her hand away from him, uncertain. The window panes across the room rattled in the violence of the storm outside.
Listen to that racket, she said. Before you got here, they were saying on Wales Today that this is the worst flooding Cardiff's ever had. But Ramsay, one of the other SHOs at the Royal, he comes in from near Bargoed, and they've had nothing up there. River's running a bit higher near him, that's all. Driving in, he said, it's like hitting a wall of water. How can that be? Owen said nothing. Urged her on with his eyes. She stared at him. No, this can't make sense. You're actually offering me a job with this Torchwood? Save the world from alien infestation? Competitive salary plus dental? Now he grinned at her. He slipped the Becquerin tool from his pocket. By twisting the central section, he folded it out to display a screen as wide as a pocket calculator. State-of-the-art equipment. Look at this. He ran the scanner over her outstretched arm. The display showed the ribbed beige surface of her jumper. He adjusted the resolution. As they both watched, the ribbing pattern slowly faded away, and they could see Megan's pale, freckled forearm. Owen tugged her arm gently, getting her to stand, and then he turned them both to face the mirror above the sofa. He stood behind Megan so that they could see themselves reflected in the octagonal mirror. He moved the Becquerin device over her forearm again, up above her bicep, across her shoulder blade, and then over her breast. The material of her white bra showed in the display, reflected back to them. Owen thumbed the resolution further, and the bra melted away to reveal the skin of her breast. It's Becquerin, said Owen from behind her, his lips close to her ear. We don't know where they come from, but they have some pretty neat gadgets. In the display, Megan's nipple was now erect. Can it go further? I mean, can it scan deeper? Show the lactiferous ducts? Or as far as the pectoralis muscles? Owen thumbed the device, and the skin disappeared as the scan displayed a subcutaneous layer, but quickly flicked it back again. I'd rather not. Megan turned to face him, eager to see the device for herself. He showed her how to adjust it, the touch-sensitive plates at its rear that looked and felt so unlike any human design. I can show you more, he urged her. When did your shift start?
Yanto wondered whether he should knock. He stood by the office door and listened for a moment, thinking that he might determine from the sound of Jack's breathing whether he was asleep. Maybe Jack had dozed off at his desk after a hard night. Maybe, but not likely, Yanto acknowledged. His knuckles hesitated beside the door jamb while he balanced the tray of coffee things in the other hand. Jack was slumped down in his office chair, his back to Yanto, exactly as he'd left him the previous night. Excellent timing. There was no sound of tiredness in his voice, but he stretched both arms wide, shrugged his shoulders as though to get the stiffness out. Even from the doorway, Yanto heard him breathe in deeply through his nose. That's a new blend, isn't it? What magic have you worked with those beans, Yanto? Good morning. Yanto moved forward into the office, his eyes growing accustomed to the lamplight. Jack scooped up a pile of papers from the desk. This made space for the coffee tray, which held a cafetiere and two cups, plus a notebook with phone messages annotated neatly in Yanto's meticulous handwriting. Yanto pressed the cafetiere to pour one cup. He handed Jack the phone messages. What is this? Bit short on detail, said they had a problem and would you please call him back at Blydrug. What sort of problem? Yanto shook his head. Didn't want to give me any more details. He sounded a bit upset. Bit strange, really. Jack drained his coffee. Jack dragged a conference phone onto one table and threw the notebook and then the phone handset at Yanto. Dial him in while I get changed. From a nearby cupboard, he pulled out one of half a dozen identical blue shirts, split the cellophane with his thumbnail, and discarded the packaging in the bin with the old shirt. Yanto finished dialing. The phone's ringtone hummed briefly around the office, and then a voice. Hello, Jonathan Meadows. Jack yelled into the air in the direction of the phone. Jonathan! It seems like we were talking only yesterday. So, early shift for you? Under the circumstances. Even in those brief words, it was clear that Meadows was trying to hold back some rebuke. The quality of the sound was good enough for Yanto to hear the scientist take a calming breath. "Mr. Harkness, we're most grateful."
"Captain Harkness," he interrupted. "But call me Jack."
Another calming breath. "Captain Harkness, we are, of course, most grateful that you've returned those 4 fuel packs."
"All part of the service, Jonathan. If we can't help our blithe droog colleagues recover their carelessly mislaid nuclear equipment, then what are we in business for?"
Jack grinned at Yanto.
Meadows persevered. "Most grateful, yes, and we know that you Torchwood people like to lay claim to things you come across. Let me assure you, Jonathan, we have no use for nuclear fuel. Everything here works off AAA batteries, believe me."
"Then what have you done with the other ones?"
"The other what?" asked Jack.
"The other 2 nuclear fuel packs," Meadows replied in an exasperated tone. There was a long pause.
"You do realize, don't you, that Wildman took 6 of them?"
A thin-faced man tapped Owen twice on the shoulder. "You can't use that thing in here." He used the same finger to point at a plastic sign on the wall that stated, "Switch off mobile phones while in the emergency department. They can interfere with sensitive medical equipment." Owen held up his mobile, which is showing no lights. "Switched it off as soon as I arrived." He slipped it into the pocket of his white doctor's coat and smiled ingratiatingly. The man before him was mid-50s, graying hair. Dark eyes peered over tortoiseshell frames, appraising Owen. The good quality shirt and silk tie and the easy authority marked him out as the man in charge, rather than another angry patient complaining about the 4-hour waiting time. Megan appeared at Owen's side.
Hello.
Haven't had a chance to introduce you both yet. A friend of yours?"
Megan nodded. "Mr. Majunath, I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to introduce you earlier. This is Dr. Owen Harper. He's a former colleague of mine. We were students together."
"Another from St. George's," interrupted Majunath, his expansive tone a complete contrast to his previous suspicion. He stuck out his arm and gave Owen a brief, firm handshake. "Amit Majunath, senior consultant. Bart's man myself. Worked there for 15 years until they lost A&E. Wasn't expecting you here, Dr. Harper. All hands to the pumps tonight, though, literally," he added, looking around them at the corridor floor, which seemed to be covered in muddy puddles and footprints. He intercepted a nurse as she tried to bustle past on her way out to reception. Owen noticed that Majunath was doing his staring over the specs business on her, too. "Can we have one of the HCAs get this cleaned up now?"
"Sorry, Mr. Majunath," replied the nurse, completely unfazed. "I'll have Kara sort it out. People have been traipsing mud in all day. The auxiliaries seem to spend all their time with mops and buckets." She disengaged her elbow from Majunath's grasp and disappeared around the corner.
"Insurance nightmare," muttered Majunath, squinting at the muddy floor. "Lucky that we don't have the management skulking around tonight. Tucked up in bed with their spreadsheets for company. We can but hope. Onwards, eh?" He stalked off towards cubicles. Owen grinned at Megan. "He's worse than you told me."
He stepped aside as a healthcare assistant appeared and started to mop the mess up around them.
Megan leaned against the wall next to Owen. "You must have switched off your mobile pretty quickly when Majunath caught you using it."
Owen shook his head. "My phone's been switched off since we left your place. He saw me using something else."
Owen slipped his hand from his white coat and held the Becquerel device for Megan to take from him.
"I palmed it for my mobile. Wouldn't do for him to get his hands on this scanner."
"You, on the other hand." Megan turned the device over in her hands, wondering. She checked to see that no one else was looking at them. The HCA was squeezing his mop into a bucket at the far end of the corridor. Megan stammered, "I'm not sure that..."
"Why not?"
Owen ushered her back towards the cubicles. "Come on, it's been a long shift. You've seen the crowd in reception. It's not getting any smaller. How do you think I spotted the emphysema case so quickly? The one your colleague thought was an obvious pneumothorax."
"You're not even supposed to be working here," persisted Megan. "You know the hospital's not insured for you. And even if it was, well, using this alien thing..."
She thrust it back at him. Owen didn't accept it. He waited. She tried to stick it in his coat pocket, but he shoved his own hands in them to prevent her.
"Come on, Megan. Isn't that why you let me come here? We could have met up afterwards.
or you could have made your own way to Torchwood. We'll go there later. I want you to see it.
She relaxed her arm, and Owen moved in to hold her shoulders. Torchwood's not just about potential benefits. It's about real and present danger. They were at the registration board. Megan started to write up notes. Owen, however, had seen something on the whiteboard scribbled in blue marker pen against cubicle 6. Sandra Applegate.
"Where's Owen?" asked Toshiko Sato's voice. Gwen turned from her desk to see Toshiko standing by the entrance to the hub's main area, bedraggled in dripping rainwater on the floor. Yanto managed to sound as though Owen's absence was his fault. "We couldn't reach him this morning. I haven't seen him since yesterday afternoon. He wasn't irradiated anymore and said he was going out to celebrate. Didn't say where. He was a bit grumpy." "What are you, his mother?" asked Jack. He gestured towards the boardroom. "Shall we?" Within minutes, they had been succinctly briefed by Jack. "So, it turns out that we still have 2 more fuel rods to locate, and our missing soldier, Sandra Applegate, is probably hunting them down as we sit here. You think she could have survived that fall?" "Gwen, she did survive that fall. Unless someone was waiting for her to drop from the window." Jack paused as though he was considering the likelihood of this. "So how can she be so resilient? Did she know she could make it?" "No. That shot merely carried her forward and she couldn't stop herself." Another pause for contemplation. "Wildman, could he really have thought he might survive that drop from the 8th floor?"
"Maybe there's something else that could survive a drop like that, but the autopsy showed that B and Wildman were human. What are we missing?" His statement was punctuated by a roll of thunder from outside.
"Ho, ho, ho," Jack laughed. "Timing, huh? And that must be some kind of storm, if we can hear it all the way down here."
"The weather has deteriorated dramatically," Toshiko told them.
"Oh, you think?" smiled Jack. "Are you dried out yet?"
Toshiko ignored him, and punched up some images on the meeting room main display. "Here are some views from around the Bay Area, the city center," more images, "the wetlands out into the Bristol Channel." The views came from traffic cameras, security cameras, CCTV. The images varied between grainy monochrome and half-lit areas through to higher quality color shots of well-illuminated buildings. What they all had in common was that they showed chaos and devastation. In the shopping areas of the city, the pedestrianized streets were awash with streams of water carrying scraps of newspaper and discarded fast food containers. Shop awnings were ripped from their metal structures and flapped madly in rage. In one road, cars crawled through a torrent of water that reached their sills. In another, a white van had slewed off the carriageway and into a postbox. "It's getting worse," Toshiko observed. They were looking at an apparently endless queue of traffic on the motorway. Gwen thought it looked like a shivering snake made up of flickering headlights. "Could it be worse?"
"You'd be surprised," replied Toshiko. Her fingers danced over the keyboard again, and a different picture emerged on the main screen. A long queue of traffic still, but this time bright sunshine sparkled off the metal trims of the motionless cars, and their vibrant colors were clearly visible. Gwen wondered if Toshiko had switched to the same stretch of motorway at an earlier point, but the time code on the image showed it was a live feed. "Where's that?"
8 miles further up the M4, Toshiko explained. "The end of the same queue, but look at the weather."
Jack looked as amazed as Gwen felt.
"How?" "The effect is localized." More keystrokes. "Here's the most recent satellite pass. About 23 minutes ago. It's like a typhoon, but restricted within an 8-kilometer radius."
"So where's the center?"
Toshiko overlaid a pattern of lines on the satellite image. "From an analysis of the variables, it's out in the bay. And you can see from the bay cameras that there's nothing out there except for plenty of churning water."
Gwen studied the composite image.
"It's underwater." "It's underwater," confirmed Toshiko. "Something must be coming through the rift below the surface. My projections show that if it continues, then it will create tidal waves across the bay. The telemetry from the boreholes is so confusing. It's as though water is flowing uphill. Thing is, even though there have been unexpected tidal surges way up the rivers Taff and Ely, it's all caused by this localized weather system."
Gwen tried to put the information together in her head and could see a flaw.
If it's localized, then where is all this rain coming from? Think of it like a localized typhoon. It's sucking water from the bay, dropping it back over the local area in this huge thunderstorm. So why is the bay not emptying? Toshiko looked at her. Where do you suppose the water there came from in the first place? Out in the Bristol Channel, and beyond that, the Celtic Sea and the Atlantic Ocean. Imagine that lot dumped all over the Vale of Glamorgan. Gwen's head was starting to spin. But a typhoon? A tropical storm in Cardiff? And I estimate that it's only Category 2 at the moment. The only good thing I can see is that the eye isn't moving. It's still out in the bay. Or at least, Toshiko checked some more figures. It's encroaching very slowly. But whatever is coming through, it's still coming. Jack slapped his hands on the table, an unexpected sound that startled Gwen. He was no longer pensive. He'd reached his decision. So, no Owen. We'll have to work without him. Yanto, keep trying his number. Gwen and Tosh, you're going to have to get out there into the bay. Find out what this thing is. Take the mini-sub. That needs two. And I'm going to find those missing power packs. Owen seized Megan's hand. Come on. We need to check out Sergeant Applegate. Sergeant? You know this woman? Megan allowed him to lead her further down from the curtain cubicles to the first of several small examination rooms. He pulled her into the cubicle and closed the door. Sandra Applegate lay on the trolley, pale and still, her breath shallow but regular. Owen could see from the monitors that she was stable. Megan was considering the patient notes and looking surprised. She's not bad for someone who's lost a lot of blood. She has a gunshot wound to the lateral portion of her upper arm, proximal humerus fracture, with the bullet retained beneath the scapula. They anticipated removing the bullet arthroscopically. Owen came around the bed and read the notes over her shoulder. They anticipated the arthroscopy? He asked. Why did they change their minds? Megan indicated the small table beside the patient's bed. In a metal bowl, they could see a bloodied bullet. The bullet was subsequently found on the bedsheet. The examining doctor suggests it must have worked its way out. Owen was about to comment on how unlikely that was when the cubicle door opened behind them. He stepped back from Megan and almost collided with a rangy, long-haired man in a scruffy white coat. The new arrival surveyed Owen. This isn't your patient. She is now, Owen bridled. He fumbled in his jacket for the ID and waggled it dismissively under the guy's nose. The doctor's tired eyes lit up. Okay, you'll want these. Radiology finally sent her second set down. He passed over a folder and slipped it before Owen could change his mind. Owen activated the light box on the wall, and the fluorescent tubes stuttered into life. He slotted the films into place and pointed out a detail to Megan. Another bullet, Megan breathed. But there's no visible damage to the mid-thoracic vertebral bodies. No bone fragments, little or no tissue damage. Think it through, Owen said. A gunshot wound to the spine would cause further nerve and tissue injury, even further from the bullet's path. Nothing in the notes here. Owen took the folder from her and closed it. It's not a bullet. And I've seen it before, in an autopsy. Megan was astonished. What is all this? You knew about this patient before you came here. Owen checked Applegate's monitors again. Satisfied himself that she was stable before he sat down on one of the visitor's chairs. We've been looking for her. We? Oh, Torchwood, right. She sat down next to him. Why is she so important? Owen watched Applegate's chest rise and fall rhythmically under the hospital gown. She is a brave and resourceful soldier, and we think she's mixed up in something she can't control. He turned away from the prone body of Applegate on the bed and leaned in towards Megan's chair. 34 years old, unmarried, only child, parents both deceased. Her army record is remarkable. Currently a respected trainer at Carrigan. But she's got a string of awards and recognition starting at only 21. Got a commendation for bravery and swift action after a shooting incident near her posting while she was off duty. Most recently, she has a QCVS and a QCB from separate tours of duty in Afghanistan. You sound impressed. She has no significant financial commitments, sometimes rents a small place in Porthcawl because it's handy for scuba diving. Her credit record is okay, no overdraft. She pays off her visa on time, in full, every month. Megan had her head in her hands now. How can you know all this? She considered Owen, perhaps seeing him differently yet again this evening. I don't even have to ask, really, do I? And all that stuff about the sniper incident and her injuries. Maybe that's why she's coped so well with her wounds tonight. But hang on. You're not shooting at her. Torchwood doesn't want to kill her. So who does? Owen pondered the question. In the ensuing silence, he could hear that Applegate's breathing had changed. She was snuffling, short staccato snorts that soon turned into coughing. Megan moved swiftly to the bedside and calmed Applegate, who was struggling with the oxygen mask. "Have you been awake for long?" Owen asked her from the foot of the bed. Applegate peered at him, waiting for the cough to subside. "For a few minutes, just long enough to hear your biography of me," she raised a wavering hand to dismiss Owen's attempt to explain. "I don't need you to say where you got that information, unlike your colleague here. Dr. Tegg, I'm supervising your treatment. Please call me Megan, Dr. Owen Harper." Applegate had composed herself a little more now. "Unlike Megan here, I do know about Torchwood. Because it was Torchwood who tried to kill me." Now that Sandra Applegate was fully conscious, Owen and Megan raised the back of her hospital bed so that she could sit up more comfortably. She was still very pale, though not the deathly gray color he'd seen earlier. Her gestures were getting stronger, and her voice no longer wavered when she spoke. "Your colleagues made a mistake, Dr. Harper. They didn't know I needed Torchwood's help." "Guess how often we hear that, Sandra?" Owen scraped his chair nearer to the bed. "So what's your story?" His tone was light, unthreatening. He watched the tension drain away from Sandra, and her face seemed to brighten. "They made a mistake. Well, I mean, I can understand it, don't get me wrong. I'd gone back to the flat for one last attempt to talk Guy out of his stupid plans. But he wasn't there. And they thought I was working with Tony and Guy. The hairdressers?" frowned Owen. Sandra rolled her eyes at him. "Tony B. and Guy Wildman, my diving buddies. So I don't blame your colleagues. It wasn't their fault, really." Sandra's eyes flickered between Owen and Megan as though quickly assessing their mood. Then she closed them and drew in a deep and shuddering breath before releasing it like a slowly deflating tire. "It started," she began, "when we took our scuba diving trip out in the bay. Nice clear day, not far, nothing too adventurous, we thought. Until we saw the hatch poking out of the sediment. First thought, of course, was that it must be discarded debris. When it wouldn't budge, then you start thinking it's a wreck. But this clearly wasn't anything like the wreck of the Luisa out there. This had a dull shine, even that far down. Modern, not 19th century, not even 20th century. When we opened it up, it was an airlock. But what kind of submarine would be buried down there? One of us should have stayed outside, but we all went in. It was an unbelievable space, more like a hallway than an airlock. And once we were in, the door shut behind us and the place started to fill with gas. The military instinct kicked in. For me and Tony, I mean, checking for exit options, areas of danger, and ensuring our backs were covered. Guy was starting to panic, though, scraping at the door with his bare hands, tearing off his mask. That's when we knew it was oxygen, and we could breathe. Our relief didn't last long, because when the inner door opened, what we saw made us abandon all that hard-learned military training. It wasn't human. I mean, like with the hatch. Your first thought is to make it normal. It's a bloke in a mask. We've stumbled into a film set. It's a weird kind of scuba gear. It wasn't. It was alien. Tony's a big guy, you know, 6'3". But this thing dwarfed him. Easily strong enough to force me and Tony further through that inner door. Guy was curled up in a corner, terrified. It picked him up and threw him after us into the ship. The alien ship. Sandra swallowed hard at this point. The next bit is all a bit hazy now. I prided myself before all this that nothing could faze me, but it's not like the uncertainties of a combat zone. No amount of readiness training could have prepared us. Maybe I was starting to react like Guy had. I don't know. All I remember now is being surrounded by alien machinery and an agonizing pain in my back. And then I must have passed out. Owen pointed up at the wall, where the light box still displayed her X-ray images. That thing was inserted into you. I think it's a tracking device. What do you remember next? When I came round, Tony was pulling me towards the exit. Guy was helping him. The pain was still intense, as though I'd been knifed in the middle of my back. Yet there was no blood. I was able to stumble out with them. Tony got us back through the airlock. Don't ask me how. I don't remember much of the journey home. Tony seemed to handle that. Maybe my mind blotted it out. Maybe it was like post-traumatic stress. We spent the rest of the weekend at Guy's apartment. Tony explained to us that we escaped because the alien ship was failing. Its crew was dying and couldn't stop us from escaping. And that's when Guy had this crazy idea that we could go back, reactivate it, maybe, or cannibalize it, at least. Owen was surprised to hear Megan laughing. And that was the crazy thing, was it? She stared at Owen and Sandra, wide-eyed, mouth opened. You're talking about alien ships as though they're real. And you, Owen, you're just encouraging her. I don't think she needs our medical attention. I think I should be calling a psychiatric nurse. Listen to what Sandra has to say. There was a note of frustration in Sandra's voice now. With Guy's professional contacts in the scientific community, who knows what he could do? He certainly knew all about Torchwood and didn't want to involve them. He'd have found some way of selling the stuff on. Well, said Megan, it doesn't sound like the kind of thing you could stick on eBay, does it? You'd be surprised, muttered Owen, and waggled the Becquerin scanner at her. Sandra had sunk back into her prop pillow. Like she'd received a physical blow, Owen reached out to touch her arm, a human touch, to restore her confidence. I understand, Sandra. Now trust me for a moment. I need to show Megan this. Lean forward if you can.
Sandra levered herself forward carefully. She started to part her hospital gown at the rear, but Owen stopped her. He beckoned Megan to watch while he passed the Becquerin scanner between Sandra's shoulder blades. Look at this.
The screen image revealed the vertebrae in Sandra's spine, but it wasn't the gray murk of an X-ray that needed close study to properly decipher its contents. Not even the artificial colors of an enhanced MRI scan. This was eerily like a post-mortem image, but the vertebrae and discs were still moving naturally as Sandra stooped forward and breathed in and out. From the sides, the vertebrae looked like white cubes in the red surrounding flesh. From the rear, the bones resolved into the familiar saddle-shaped structures that straddled the off-white intervertebral discs. See, urged Owen? Between T3 and T4, just to one side, attached to the spinal column, but not within it. A sphere of metal, like burnished chrome, with a soft inner light somehow pulsing within it. Not a bullet, he said quietly. You've seen it for yourself, Megan. What is there not to believe? She looked like she might be about to cry. Shouldn't we take this to someone? Shouldn't you have gone to the authorities, Sandra? Sandra settled into her pillow again. You're the one who said I needed a psychiatric nurse. What do you think the army would have said? The end of my career, whatever happened. She watched them both cautiously. So I've come to you. To Torchwood. And I know what happened to Guy and Tony. She covered her face with both hands and began to weep silently. Dry sobs heaved her shoulders. Owen put a hand gently on her arm, calming her, while he quietly explained to Megan about the deaths of Bee and Wildman. We have to go back, Sandra blurted out. There was a fresh urgency in her voice. Steady, Megan warned her, and rose to check the monitors. You've had a gunshot wound. I know you're a very fit soldier, but for anyone else, I'd have been arranging a bed in ITU at best. She was considering the evidence of the monitors in wonder. Oh, and could this thing in her spine be helping her? Do you think? That's why I have to go back, Sandra interrupted. I want to get this tracer thing out of my back, and I can't do that with conventional surgery here in the hospital. I could be paralyzed. But your doctors, if you return with me to that ship, you could use the machine that inserted this thing to remove it again. Owen studied her. That's a thought.
Megan was infuriated. She's in no condition to travel. I have nothing to fear from capture now. I'm a trained soldier. I've wrecked the area already. And besides, the aliens are all dead.
And in this weather, protested Megan, it's the alien vessel that's causing these freakish weather conditions.
Sandra grasped Owen's hand. Surely you could stop the ship. Save the bay.
I can take Torchwood there. Contact your colleagues.
I think we can handle this. Owen patted her hand and released it.
He looked at Megan and grinned. The familiar adrenaline buzz was kicking in. It was like his head was fizzing with an exhilaration that he thought had been gone for too long.
Megan, this is it. Your chance to see what Torchwood is all about firsthand.
It's insane. Crazy. Crazy is what makes me feel alive. Come on. What's keeping you here?
He made a wild gesture that encompassed the room, the department, the hospital, her whole life.
Why accept just this?
He stood and watched her intently, his eyes urging her to decide. Sandra made a decision first.
If you won't help me, then I'll have to do it for myself.
She started to pluck the sensors from her body. As each sharp tug removed another one, the ECG machine flatlined and began to ping a warning.
I won't stay here, insisted Sandra. And you can't make me. I'll take my chances on my own.
All right, Megan hurried to Sandra's side, trying to calm her at the same time as helping her with the sensors and wiping away the remaining conductive gel beneath them.
The examination room burst open as a nurse barged her way in.
Dr. Tegg, I heard the ECG alarm went off.
That's okay, Bobby. Megan switched off the ECG monitor and the alarm stopped at once.
Here, sort out her drips.
So, said Sandra brightly, how long will it take to get discharged from here?
How long is a piece of red tape? Smiled the nurse.
Now that Sandra had stood up, she was pressing her forehead gently with one hand. Megan moved to the door. I'll sort out some portable analgesia.
Sandra flexed her arm where the nurse had removed the saline drip and attached a plaster in the crook of her elbow.
Owen, can you get my discharge papers sorted out while I get dressed here? I'll come and meet you out at reception.
A soldier who protected her modesty, thought Owen. But he just said, sure.
And I'm absolutely famished, Sandra told him as he was leaving the room.
But I'm sure Nurse Nottingham here can help me get a bite to eat.
Jack had brought a laser cutter and an axe. Up in Wildman's apartment, he pulled all the furniture towards the center of the room and tossed pictures and wall hangings on top of them so he could methodically test the cavity walls. Where he found that the plasterboard sounded hollow, he applied the laser cutter to slice a hole through it. Within half an hour, there were scorched gaps in every wall and in the backs of all the fitted cupboards. There was no sign of any lead boxes. A similar search of the small gap under the floorboards yielded nothing either. He sat amid the piled furniture in the middle of the living area. Could Applegate have smuggled them out already when they were last here? The Geiger counters hadn't recorded anything, but she'd been wearing a long coat, and perhaps that had concealed a smaller lead-lined carrier. So where could Applegate be now? Alone, wounded. He pondered this before deciding to call Toshiko at the hub.
The call connected on the second attempt. Toshiko told him that she and Gwen were already mobile and were en route for the bay in Gwen's car.
Any news from Owen? Jack asked her. The signal was poor and the line intermittent, so they both found they were shouting to make themselves understood.
Has he called in?
He may have tried, crackled Toshiko's voice from the mobile.
But in these conditions, who can tell?
There was buzzing interruption and Jack had to get her to repeat what she had said.
I had an idea about checking his mobile phone records. Owen received a call last night from a Megan Tegg. She's a senior house officer at the Cardiff Royal Infirmary. And a quick cross-reference shows she and Owen were at university together in London. Good work, Tosh. I can look into that once I've tracked down Applegate. Thanks. Catch you later.
Jack sat for a while, surveying the wreckage of Wildman's apartment. Applegate was wounded and alone.
Of course. Where would a woman with a gunshot wound go for emergency treatment?
Megan drove them out to the northwestern shore of Cardiff Bay, between the stylish frame of St. David's Hotel and the outlet of the River Taff. She was following directions from Sandra, who was hunched in the back, staring out of the car window and trying to make out landmarks made strange by the rain and the gloomy afternoon light. Megan slewed the Skoda to a halt and pulled the handbrake into position with a ratcheting noise that made Owen's teeth grind. "We need to walk from here," Sandra told them. She popped open the door and stepped out into the storm before they could protest.
"I must be insane," Megan told Owen. "What am I doing driving on a night like this?"
They followed Sandra as she set off at a determined pace down a gravel walkway that led into the reserve. The howl of the wind made it impossible to speak, and even when he shouted, Owen could barely make himself heard. He took hold of Megan's hand to encourage her as much as to support her physically. Eventually, Sandra gestured at something that was poking up through the nearby reeds. It looked like a lump of burnished metal. The dark water lapped over it as the wind whipped up the waves. Sandra stooped down and lifted a concealed flap to reveal a curiously shaped panel of sparkling light. She activated one of the controls and motioned for them to stand well back. The water around the burnished metal surged and frothed. Within a minute, a tall, wide cylinder had risen from the murky water. As the cylinder displaced the surge of water, Owen squatted, pulling Megan down gently as he did so. An escape pod. Sandra opened a small doorway in the cylinder and beckoned for them to follow her in. It was a cramped space, no wider than three telephone boxes stacked side by side. There were four molded alcoves in the wall, orientated vertically. Owen noted that they appeared to be designed for a humanoid figure somewhat larger than the average man, and he remembered how Sandra had described the aliens earlier. At the far end of the craft, he could see another softly flickering set of controls. Once they were all in the cylinder, Sandra activated one of the controls, and the entrance door slid shut. Owen felt his ears go pop as the air pressure inside changed. The raging noise of the storm outside had suddenly reduced to a dull murmur. The rocking motion of the craft started to disorient him. "It'll be much better once we're under the water." Sandra slumped into the nearest of the alcoves and struggled to strap herself in. It was as though she was afraid that she might fall down if she didn't somehow secure herself. Now that she was out of the rain, the blood from the wound in her shoulder was starting to seep down her sleeve and out over her hand. The frantic energy that had sustained her through the car journey had dissipated. "I said you weren't well enough to travel," insisted Megan. She checked Sandra's eyes and took a pulse from her neck. Clearly not entirely happy with what she found, Megan slipped a box syringe from her jacket pocket and administered a painkiller. Then she checked the pulse in her neck again. Sandra wriggled her head away from Megan as far as the molded restraint would let her. "We have no time. We have to get to the ship and stop it. Secure yourself in a harness for the journey." Owen helped Megan to slot her small frame into one of the alcoves. She gave a little squeal as he fixed one of the straps. "Steady, that pinches!" "Now hold on to these grips." He moved her hands into position. Owen shuffled around on the spot and saw that Sandra was pressed back into her alcove. The rain had plastered her short blonde hair flat, and her skin was ashen. "Okay, we better get going," he told her. "I presume you know how this thing works." She nodded feebly. It was easy enough to operate the escape pod. It didn't have much speed, and the direction controls were simple. Owen was soon able to dispense with Sandra's explanations about the function of the pod's controls and concentrate on her instructions about where to move the craft rather than how. Sandra directed Owen to maneuver the pod along the Rhine, a moat that ran the entire length of the reserve. To the south, still within the waters of the bay, Owen steered a course past a large stone bund for several hundred meters. It was defunct, no longer able to protect the wetlands, as water-borne debris inundated the area with each fresh surge of water. But it was still high enough above the bed of the bay to remain a danger to the escape pod. Once clear of the bund, it was a straight run across the bay. Eventually, Sandra heaved a huge sigh. For one dreadful moment, Owen feared that it was a death rattle. When he checked, he saw to his surprise that her eyes were more alive than ever. She was peering intently through the observation window and delighted with what she saw. Owen followed her gaze and had to gasp himself. This wasn't what Sandra had described to them in the hospital. This was more than just a simple hatch poking out of the seabed. It was a curving expanse of dull metal, glinting with a soft inner glow, even at this depth in the cloudy water. The silt at the base of it, where the vessel emerged from the sediment, was vibrating as though the whole edifice was juddering its way into reality, slowly forcing its way through the rift. The escape pod jolted, and Owen felt the controls resist his hands. He relinquished his grip, and watched the controls continue to move without his assistance. The autopilot was in operation, and the escape pod was still in motion. They were going in.
"I won't be pleased if my car gets washed away," Gwen told Toshiko. "Relax. It's well up the causeway. And how else are we going to get the trailer out here?" "Yeah, well, you've seen how far up the water level is now." Gwen indicated the view from the starboard porthole of the submersible. 100 meters away, the lights of Mermaid Key sparkled in the rain. The murky late afternoon was so dark that the light detectors on the street lamps had already activated. Toshiko peered out too, and together they watched the waves from the bay surge up over the wooden walkway around the quay. The boards in front of Torchwood's tourist information entrance were submerged by as much as a meter of water, completely covering Yanto's overly optimistic pile of sandbags. "The tidal barrage has already been breached," explained Toshiko. She was checking the computer display that fed her information from the local authority computer she had hacked. "The sluice gates failed about an hour ago. The bay area is usually a couple of meters below spring tide, but even that can't account for this much flooding." "Why's that?" "Well, it's not like the Bristol Channel has suddenly got a lot deeper. So how has the water level in the bay risen by 3 meters? Or 4 meters in some places? It's like a localized bubble of water angled out of the sea." "I didn't think water behaved like that," said Gwen. "You're right, so let's go and find out what's causing it." She settled herself in front of the controls and prepared to dive. The large hemispherical window in front of her afforded them a view of the bay's heaving water. The whole vessel lurched as another large wave surged beneath them. Gwen watched nervously as the nose of their vessel started to sink down. Dirty green seawater began to lap higher and higher against the large front window. Was it her imagination, or was the air getting thicker in here? She closed her eyes and took slow, deep breaths. "What's this thing called, then?" she asked, hoping that conversation might divert her for a while. "What do you imagine?" Toshiko smiled, as the water covered them completely. "The Torchwood sub, of course." It helped that he knew what to expect when the airlock opened. Owen remembered what Sandra had told them back in the A&E department, and it wasn't like he hadn't seen an alien spaceship before now. For Megan, it would be a different matter. He'd expected to offer her a slow build-up, a gradual introduction to the wonders and astonishments and, yes, the horrors of the extraterrestrial. Sandra's unexpected arrival had put the markers on that, hadn't it? So here was Megan, learning it the hard way, seeing firsthand an alien spaceship that had crashed on her very doorstep. Owen took her by the hand to help her out of the escape pod and continued to hold it tightly as they ventured deeper into the unknown corridors. In stark contrast to the ship's exterior, the inside was softly illuminated in a wide variety of green hues. It was as though the murky water of the bay had been transformed into aquamarines and apple green. Soft sage-colored fronds dangled from a high arched ceiling. Dark green walls pulse with the arcane bright outlines of unknown symbols or images. To either side, the corridor walls were punctuated by dark shafts leading downwards to who knew where, each hissing with the faintest wisp of steam. Sandra shuffled ahead of them. When Owen asked her where the control room was, she merely beckoned him on with her hand without turning around. After only a few minutes, they turned into a large room. 6 scooped frames, each like an elongated letter J, were suspended by thick olive-green tendrils from a darkened ceiling. They faced towards the center of a circle. At its center was a pale cylinder that might have been a table, and at the head of the circle was a closed cabinet fashioned from what looked like jade. Sandra staggered into the room and slumped against the cylinder. Owen took a quick look at Megan, who was still wide-eyed and speechless with amazement. He let go of her hand and hurried across to Sandra. She shrugged him off, a feeble effort that seemed to rack her with pain. "No," she insisted. "You must take up positions in the control frames." He looked at her, uncertain. "Hurry," she hissed. "The ship will..."
Her body was racked with a huge cough. It will destroy the bay! She stepped awkwardly away from the cylinder and indicated to Megan that she should use one of the scoop frames. Megan looked to Owen for confirmation. When he nodded to her, she leaned back and sat in the middle frame. Owen took the one next to her. Sandra was already helping Megan to fasten the tendrils around her in the frame, like a seatbelt. Next, she did the same for Owen. The tendrils went taut, and he could feel them forcing him back against the hard frame. "Ow!" shouted Megan. Owen laughed and settled into his frame. "Is it a bit tight again? Get Sandra to loosen it a bit." Then Megan began to scream. Owen craned his head forward. Sandra was standing by the pale cylinder in the center. Her whole posture made her look exhausted, like she was ready to drop down in front of him. But her eyes were different. They were alive, glittering with satisfaction, and in the soft green light of the room, her grin was a startling rictus. He didn't have time to say anything. The tendrils around him snapped tight and pulled his head back hard against the frame. Megan's screaming abruptly stopped. By squinting sideways, Owen could see Megan's head slump forward like an abandoned rag doll. "Let her go!" he yelled at Sandra. His voice seemed lost in the room. Sandra limped over to him, still showing that terrible smile. "We've only just made it in time, Owen." The effort of speaking racked her. "This particular body's reached the end of its use, but I couldn't relinquish it until we got here." She indicated the whole room. "See you again. Soon." The light in her eyes seemed to vanish like an extinguished candle. Where previously there had been a kind of triumph in her expression, now there was only incomprehension, confusion, and pain. Sandra glanced around the room in bewilderment, then dropped to the floor like she'd been poleaxed. Owen struggled against his restraints. His futile efforts were cut short by a buzzing noise and brightening light that engulfed the frame beside him. With a whipping sound, the tendrils around Megan withdrew and vanished. Megan stepped out of her frame. "Get me out of this thing, Megan," called Owen. "It hasn't released me." "It's not supposed to," said Megan. Her voice was calm and secure. She walked slowly around the cylinder with the confident gait of someone who knew she was safe. Megan held her hands in front of her, turning them over, examining them as though they were a thing of wonder and novelty. When she looked at him, Owen could see there was no more terror in her eyes. "Hello again," she said to him. "Who are you?" Megan smiled. "Let me show you." She placed her palms on the top of the pale cylinder. Lights within it responded to her touch as she stroked the surface. The jade cabinet at the front of the circle cracked from top to bottom as a pair of irregular hinged doors opened up. Suspended inside, seated in a larger version of the scoop J-shaped frames, was a tall, ugly alien. Bipedal, broad-shouldered with binocular vision, its head lolled in the seat, and its skull was a carapace of etched bone. Its thin arms ended in long, thick, dirty claws. The whole of the creature's torso heaved as it took shallow breaths through the slit of its mouth. Megan walked over to the cabinet. "This is the real me." "You're tingling. It's a fantastic feeling, isn't it?" "You met him at the university disco. What sort of cliche is that?" Owen was the thin-faced, nervous lad with the good cheekbones you'd seen in anatomy, and joked with Amanda that you'd like to examine his anatomy more closely. "And did she know his name?" Amanda had identified him as a local boy, Owen Harper, and declared him to be a rat-faced loser with a cruel mouth. You'd seen something else in him. And then there he was, nursing his pint at the back of the disco, while his better-looking mate was hitting on your better-looking mate and eating her face off during some slow Alanis Morissette record. He was never going to make the first move, was he? Though you could see his hungry eyes following you around the dance floor, peering into the bright maelstrom of red and blue and green and white, surveying your every move.
so you'd banged into his table and spilled his drink, and thus it began. The following morning was the first of many when you'd wake first and see him sleeping beside you, admiring his long, dark lashes above his freckled white cheeks. Can you ever see yourself as others see you? Most recently, as Sandra Applegate. You caught sight of your face in the mirror at Wildman's apartment, pale and tired, the blood smeared over your mouth and chin and staining your favorite coat. Before that, you watched your reflection in the shop windows as you ran for safety down the high street and into the building site. And earlier still, you studied your nakedness in the mirror that hung over the corner sink in your room at the barracks. Amazed and amused that your pale pink body, with its curious musculature protected by a thin epidermis, was considered by humans as a peak of fitness. Confusingly, you thought you were in peak condition, too. It's a curious double life to live. You close the doors to the life support unit and seal your true self into the protective cocoon. When you turn around, you can see Owen in the restraint chair. His look is full of fear and fury. "I told you," you tell him calmly. "That thing is the real me. My body is in stasis to protect me from the crash injuries. The rest of the warship's crew were killed during the collision and brought us to this strange place. I need to return to Breedak for medical attention." Owen has stopped struggling against his bonds now. "That's good. What's happened to Sandra?" "We were supposed to be stopping the ship from coming through the rift and then removing that tracker from her spine." You prod Sandra's slump body with your toe. "Not exactly what I had planned, Owen. It's not a tracker, you see. It's a control box. Though it's strange. As Sandra, I was able to control you without having to insert a control box in your spine. And now that I'm controlling Megan, now that I am Megan, I can understand why." "Let her go," Owen is pleading. "You don't need her. We're medics. We can help you, the real you, I mean, to recover and get away from here." You place your fingers gently on his lips and silence him. "I am a Breedak warrior." His eyes meet yours again, and you know that he sees he has lost you. "I am not Megan anymore," you tell him. "The Breedak stealth technology lets me use the captured inhabitants of the planets we invade. By possessing our prisoners in this way, we can infiltrate the native population in perfect disguise. And when I finish with each person, I can release them wherever they are and return my consciousness back here to the ship, or to another prisoner. The Sub-Aqua team, he's as smart as you remember him. They stumbled upon your crashed warship, and you've used each of them in turn. The problem with you humans, you tell Owen, is that the possession just burns up so much of your meager supply of cerebrospinal fluid. Fortunately, it's easy enough to obtain more from other humans. You explain to him that you have discovered a lot from the humans you've possessed. From B and Applegate, you learned about Earth's military structures. From Wildman, you discovered a way to refuel the ship with Earth's crude nuclear technology. And from all of them, you conclude, I learned that they suspect and fear and despise Torchwood. So I was intrigued to discover that you work for Torchwood. His face is like stone. Now, Megan, you say to him, she's a doctor, isn't she? She has a thorough understanding of the strengths and weaknesses of the human form, physical, emotional, and she's young and strong, too. She can get me back to the shore. She can retrieve the remaining nuclear packs that Wildman concealed. I still need those to refuel this warship. Not much more to do before you go now. If you concentrate, you can feel the creature growing within you. There is the bubbling stir of rising gas, a stirring in your stomach. With one brief heave, you regurgitate the tiny starfish creature and spit it out. It splays its four legs on the floor beside Sandra Applegate's shivering body. Owen sees this, and his revulsion is clear. You find yourself moving closer to him. He cannot move in the restraint, and you have to angle your head to kiss him softly on his lips. At first he resists with his mouth set in a firm, hard line, and then his feelings begin to overwhelm him, and he softens. That's when you activate the device. Owen's whole body stiffens as the restraint frame punches a control box into his spine.
He can't stop himself screaming with the sudden, agonizing pain. Now his eyes are staring at yours in horror and disbelief. Now they're glazing over. Now the head restraint relaxes, and his head slumps forward in the frame. Jack was used to being able to enter anywhere and take charge at once. It wasn't like that in Cardiff Royal Infirmary A&E tonight. Jack had to squeeze his way into the building past a furious crowd who were being sent back into the thunderstorm by frustrated, irate hospital staff unable to cope with any more patients. The waiting room ached with sullen frustration and was filled to bursting with people who had already been allowed in. The whole place smelled of mud and sweat and anger. Jack had located the staff picture board. He scanned its contents quickly to locate the guy in charge. The photographs told him the red-haired receptionist was Kirsty Donald. The nearby nurse was Kaima Hassentunen. Megan Tegg was a senior house officer, slim-faced, short dark hair, cute rather than pretty. Definitely Owen's type. The clinical director, acting, was Amit Majunat. Gray hair, thick glasses, slightly scarred face, best-dressed guy on the board. Jack had already pissed off one consultant by abandoning the SUV across her reserved parking space, and within a few more minutes, here was another, refusing to answer any of Jack's questions. "We'll get to you as fast as we can, honestly," Majuna told him for the third time. The consultant peered over his glasses at an LED display that repeatedly scrolled its mournful red warning above the reception desk. Estimated waiting time, 5 hours. "So, Mr. Harkness, please put your ID away. There's really no point you flaunting your credentials in here." "He can flaunt his credentials at me anytime," the red-haired receptionist muttered and smirked at the nurse, who was checking paperwork at her desk. Jack caught her eye and grinned. She hadn't thought that he could overhear her, and her pretty face blushed so deeply that her freckles almost disappeared. She picked up a folder and hid behind it. "I'm going to have to insist," Jack began. He was interrupted by three trolleys being wheeled between him and the consultant, each bearing a soaking wet victim in urgent need of treatment. "Insist all you like, Mr. Harkness," Majunet replied wearily. He turned to address the latest ambulance crew, straight through to recess. "I'm right behind you." He held up his hands to forestall Jack's renewed remonstration. "As soon as I can, I promise. We want to know who murdered Bobby as much as you do, more so, I dare say. We've sealed off the crime scene, and you can use the relatives' room as your base of operations if you wish. No doubt you'll need that when the rest of your team arrives. But you must see we're drowning tonight." "Wait a minute," protested Jack. "Murdered who?" But Majunet was already off into recess. Jack knew he didn't have much time. If they'd called the police, then chasing the consultant was not going to be fast enough to get what he wanted. On the reception desk, the redhead was saying goodbye to the nurse. Jack sauntered up to the counter. "Hi, Kirsty," he told her. "Captain Jack Harkness." She blushed again and tried to hide it by facing her computer screen and typing. "Can I have your address?" "Fast work. I like that," he grinned. "Shouldn't we go for dinner or something first?" She ducked her head down, grinning too. I'm sorry. I meant that I need your details to book you in." Jack showed his ID. "I'm not a patient. I'm here to investigate the murder. Mr. Majunet said you'd help." Kirsty's expression changed suddenly and completely. "Are you here to find out who killed Bobby?" She blinked rapidly. I mean, Roberta Nottingham. He kept his reassuring smile going. "Yeah, need to see the scene." Jack let Kirsty lead him to a treatment room, but didn't allow her in with him. She returned to her desk full of gratitude. The security guard posted on the treatment room door unlocked it and let him in. Jack slipped in unaccompanied and saw the body. In less than a minute, he'd seen enough. Enough time to confirm that this was the same kind of killing as before. Enough to know it wasn't Owen. Enough time to find the Becquerin deep tissue scanner casually abandoned beside a stainless steel kidney dish on an instrument tray. Jack asked the security guard to relock the room, and he returned to the front desk. Kirsty Donald was engaged in a frustrated conversation with a guy whose sharp suit was matched by his slick patter. While the sales guy held Kirsty's attention, Jack surreptitiously looked at the admissions details on the desk beside her. Sandra Applegate was near the top, discharged an hour ago.
Jack cut straight across the sales guy's patter as though he wasn't there. Kirsty, is Dr. Tegg available for an interview at the moment?
I think I was speaking, actually, interjected the sales guy, his eyes flared with anger behind his strained but polite tone.
I don't care, actually, Jack told him.
Why don't you take your briefcase and sit on it, over there? 5 hours waiting time.
Thanks, Kirsty smiled at him with evident relief. I'm afraid Dr. Tegg went off duty about an hour ago. She left with another doctor. Good-looking guy, too. Jack laughed at Kirsty's transparent attempt to exaggerate Owen's appeal. Or perhaps he was her type. And he should convince her that the salesman was a better prospect tonight. There he was against the wall, sitting on his briefcase and looking resentfully over at them.
Briefcase, thought Jack. Wildman had a briefcase when he chased him through town, but he didn't still have it when Jack caught up with him on the 8th floor of the building site. He must have concealed it somewhere in the partly constructed building. Jack beckoned the sales guy over to the reception desk. The thin guy jumped off his case and scurried across.
Mr. Majinet will be free in an hour, Jack told him. You should talk to Kirsty about setting up a meeting. And when you've got that sorted, she can get you to see the clinical director, too. He pointed to the wall opposite. Don't lose your briefcase. Another couple of minutes in the sub with Toshiko might have driven Gwen insane. Toshiko was going on about algal populations and how they change depending on the temperature in the bay or the amount of sunlight or some nutrient or other. Gwen was a lot less interested in how algae formed a scum on the surface than in finding the scum who'd been killing people back on shore. It was almost possible to forget all of that when they got into the alien ship.
The alien ship. Gwen had to say it to herself over and over. The alien ship. She'd never seen anything like it. Never been inside an alien ship. There'd been the meteor strike, and she'd seen fragments of the transportation shell they dug up in the foundations of a new supermarket. This was different.
While Toshiko was making sure the sub was safely connected to the outer hull, and that there was air inside for them to breathe, Gwen had been wondering how it would look. She'd expected it to be like a film set. After all, she'd sat yawning through enough DVD special features with Reese to know how the effects were done, that the sets were lit specially and then the post-production effects made the places look, literally, out of this world.
This was beyond anything Reese could have imagined. The only thing Gwen recognized here was the smell of salt water in the air. The rest was, why was she surprised? Alien.
She swallowed hard to release the pressure building in her ears. They stepped deeper into the ship. It's getting darker, worried Toshiko. Her handheld computer wasn't giving her any reassurance. The floor heaved beneath their feet, and a bass growl came from somewhere deep inside the ship. It's still lurching through the rift, explained Toshiko. It's shaking about like a stalling car. The ship could be tearing itself apart in the process.
There's a cheering thought, Gwen told her.
At a kind of T-junction, Toshiko took the left-hand fork, and Gwen hastened to join her. They entered a wide expanse that contained a circle of suspended cages. They faced inwards towards a cylindrical block at the center. One of the cages was enclosed at the front.
But that wasn't what had alarmed Toshiko.
She was pointing mutely at the third cage along. Owen was slumped in it. Head drooped to one side, face pallid, eyes closed. Gwen started forward to see if she could free him, but Toshiko held her back.
Careful, she hissed.
A short-haired blonde woman lay in an awkward heap in front of Owen's cage. In the half-light of the room, it seemed to Gwen at first that a large vein in the woman's neck was throbbing. Gwen stooped to take a closer look, gasped, and immediately leapt away again. One of the starfish creatures was attached to the woman's neck, arching up and down like a hand pressing up against the woman's jaw. Gwen reached for her gun.
You can't fire that in here, snapped Toshiko. The whole place is pressurized.
Gwen holstered her weapon and took out her torch. She waited until the starfish creature was on one of its upward movements and then prized it free with the lamp end of the torch. It rolled away from the woman's head on its back, the four legs waggling pathetically as it struggled to regain a grip. Gwen pushed it further away with the torch, noting how the mouth section in the center puckered in a foul parody of disappointment.
The woman's neck and lower face were a raw mass of part-digested flesh. Her lips were eaten away at one side, revealing the teeth and lower jaw. Gwen hefted the heavy torch and brought it down in a sharp blow in the center of the creature. It squeaked. She slammed it with another blow, and another, until its center was pulped and two arms had detached. It wasn't twitching anymore. "Okay, stop now!" Toshiko was holding her arm. Gwen dropped the torch, and the light rolled around the room in a bright swirl until it came to a halt in the sticky remains. Toshiko gave her arm a quick squeeze of reassurance and then stooped down over the blonde woman. By playing her own torch over the remaining half of the woman's face, she could identify her. Sandra Applegate. She carefully felt for a pulse in the remaining half of her neck. "Nothing we can do." Toshiko stood up again and examined Owen in his cage. His breathing was slow but regular. When she lifted his lids, his eyes were rolled right back into his head. The ship heaved and shuddered more profoundly than before. "Let's get him out of this thing," Toshiko told Gwen. "We need to get him back to the hub." Once Toshiko had worked out how to release Owen from his confinement, his body dropped out of the contraption as a dead weight. Gwen caught him, her knees buckling under the weight. Toshiko grabbed his legs and they half-carried, half-dragged him from the glowing circle of cages and out through the corridors toward the Torchwood sub. The alien vessel bucked and warped around them. Gwen couldn't tell how much of that was supposed to happen and how much was the ship twisting dangerously out of shape as it struggled to fully breach the rift. She was too busy dragging the profoundly unconscious Owen to worry about it too much. Toshiko laid Owen down carefully at the rear of the sub. It wasn't designed as an ambulance, and he looked awkward and uncomfortable where he lay. "We should bring the other body," Gwen said. "And put it where?" Gwen looked at Toshiko coldly. She remembered the dead woman's partially digested face. "We can't leave her. I can't leave her, Tosh." Gwen didn't ask again. She ran back through the corridors, determined not to be distracted by the vine-like wiring and sudden splashes of emerald light. Although the rattling shudder of the vessel was increasing, she managed to drag the corpse of Sandra Applegate back to the sub. At every step, she had to force herself to look away from the woman's ravaged face. Yanto was not pleased. Not that he'd do anything so presumptuous as to say anything, Gwen knew. It was the absence of his usual cheery demeanor when she and Toshiko got him to carry Sandra Applegate's corpse into the hub. Yanto deposited Applegate's corpse in the pathology room while Gwen helped Toshiko to carry Owen to the medical area. They so rarely needed to use it, and the last time Gwen had been in here had been when Owen was showing her around and showing off. The suite contained an examination room and three bedrooms, each an incongruous mix of stark medical white and Victorian brickwork. Owen remained profoundly unconscious. As Gwen made him comfortable, she reflected that this was probably not how Owen would have imagined her helping him into bed. Toshiko switched on a dusty computer by the bedside and connected up several monitors to Owen's body. Gwen had no idea what went where, and from Toshiko's look of concentration, it seemed clear that it wasn't something she had done recently. Yanto knocked politely at the door, and she beckoned him in. "Have you been able to reach Jack?" He looked apologetic, almost forlorn. "No connection at all. The storm has wiped everything out." He went over to the computer terminal by the bed. "Meanwhile, I've done a quick scan of the corpse you brought back. It does appear to contain one of those spinal attachments, but it's completely burned out." He tapped at the keyboard to call up the scan results. Toshiko took a mouse and arranged the computer image so that it showed a split screen. One half showed Yanto's scanned image. In the other, Toshiko displayed a second scan of Owen. Clearly visible below his neck was the stark outline of a new spinal attachment. "He's alive," Yanto said simply. It sounded like a plea. Toshiko sat down on a chair, suddenly weary. He needs a doctor. The main reception area of the building smelled dank. The boarding and covers that surrounded it were hopelessly insufficient to keep the rainstorm from blowing through the shell of the unfinished building. And a wide expanse of water had pooled across a concrete floor. Four main stairwells led up into the body of the site. Jack tried to remember which one he had pursued Wildman up 2 days ago. It was the far corner. He hurried across, poked his head around the hole where the doorframe would go, and held his breath to listen. Jack heard the clattering footfall of someone who didn't know they should be keeping quiet. He unholstered his gun and started quietly up into the building. He hugged the breeze blocks that formed the sides of the stairwell. That kept him away from the sharp drop beyond the edge of the steps. It also enabled him to lean against the wall and stare up to where he could hear the footsteps. The regular slap of shoe on stair had stopped, and now the sound was of feet sliding across concrete. The intruder was walking around looking for something, looking for Wildman's briefcase. Jack slipped up the remaining stairs as quickly and silently as he could. On what he counted to be the eighth floor, he stepped out into the main floor area and covered the whole area with his gun. Megan Tegg had the slim face he recognized from the photograph board at the hospital, but she didn't look cute anymore. In the half-light of the room, she looked startled and then angry. She tried hopping across the finished floor, avoiding the concrete reinforcement wire and attempting to hide behind one of the central pillars, but Jack slid smartly to one side and had her covered again. A flash of lightning brilliantly illuminated the whole area, and the ensuing peal of thunder demonstrated how close the strike was. Megan was clutching the briefcase tightly in her right hand, and her head flicked from side to side as she considered her exit routes. "Give it up, Megan," Jack called, his voice loud and clear despite the pounding of the rain and another crack of lightning. He hopped over a couple of girders to get nearer to her and pointed at the briefcase. "Thanks for finding that. I thought I'd let you lead me to it, rather than hunt for it myself." Megan considered the gap that yawned beneath them, backed away carefully towards the exterior of the building, felt for the floor with her feet all the way back. He followed her carefully. She had reached the wooden platform outside. Wind and rain whipped around the edge and into the building, lashing the torn green exterior covering repeatedly against the metal scaffolding. Megan chanced to look behind her. "Nowhere to run," Jack told her. Megan faced him again. Her anger had dissipated. She reached out slowly with her left hand to clutch a scaffolding pole. In the next flash of lightning, Jack saw her knuckles were white where she gripped the briefcase handle in her other hand. Jack kept his eyes locked on Megan's, not offering her an excuse to break this look between them, as though it physically bound them together. "You're good, aren't you?" cooed Megan. Another flicker of lightning revealed that she was licking her lips. Nervous or relishing in the moment? "I'm a warrior," she said. There was pride in her voice now. She let go of the scaffolding, and it seemed to Jack that she was standing taller. "I want to return home." Megan hefted the briefcase up, slowly so she would not alarm him. It was heavy. He could see the strain in her arms. Jack's Geiger counter showed negligible radiation. Megan was showing him her means of escape. "To do that, I must refuel and launch my ship." "Need briefcase, lead-lined?" "Why don't you just let me get out of here?" asked Megan. "I can be gone within the hour." She was watching him for a reaction. He knew it, and didn't give her one. "You could even help me, Jack." Now that got a reaction, and she saw it at once. "It is Jack, isn't it?" He tightened his grip on the revolver, made sure his stance on the concrete was steady, his feet solidly placed. "Now how would you know that?" Jack considered the options. "Right. Owen told you. Or he told Megan. Same difference. 'Cause you're not Megan anymore, are you?" "I've only borrowed her," pouted the alien. "Think of it like renting a car." She backed away from him, moving further along the scaffolding. "Stay where you are," bellowed Jack. "You're not borrowing anything. You're killing humans indiscriminately." "I release them in the end." "Yeah, I've seen that," retorted Jack. "Just here. You remember that, right? You release them when they are incapacitated. No inconvenient loose ends, because you condemn them to death before you let go. By which point it's too late for them to do anything but die." "You're wrong about me," she said. Her voice was calm but clear, even against the noise of the storm. "I retain memories of the humans I possessed. I learn what they learn, know what they know, feel what they feel. Put the gun away, Jack. You don't need to hurt me to make me understand about human suffering and pain. I know how Bee and Applegate loved and respected one another, how Wildman craved the respect of his friends and never knew that he'd earned it. I know how Owen Harper screwed up my life and broke me into pieces that I never put together again. That's not you. You're not Megan. The alien used her eyes, her expression, her whole demeanor in a desperate entreaty. I am Megan. She's here. But so much more. A gust of rain buffeted them through the open side of the building. Megan shuffled aside and wrapped her arm around the nearest scaffolding post. She was in no rush to take a leap, Jack decided.
Let her go, he demanded. You know nothing of what it is to be human.
I know enough. I know you talk a good story about human rights, but I know that some humans have more rights than others. Come on, Megan taunted him. Why did no one care about a few dead vagrants? I took them for sustenance because Bee and Wildman and the others knew no one would miss them. Imagine if I'd killed a couple of stockbrokers, eh? Or a policeman.
You did kill a policeman.
Policemen and those soldiers.
Megan shuffled uncomfortably. Not so many hobos around an army base.
Needs must... A nurse who attended Applegate. People who wanted to help. So why should I help you now? To put an end to it?
Megan's tone was hopeful, pleading. The human need to survive. You've surrendered that right, said Jack. Give me those fuel packs or I'll shoot you where you stand. Another crash of lightning. Jack saw that Megan was half hidden by the scaffolding poles now. Get back out here, he told her. She slid further behind the scaffolding. Jack lowered the muzzle of the revolver, squeezed the trigger, and shot Megan through her right foot. The report from the weapon was shattering, echoing off the bare concrete walls. Megan shrieked in shock and anger and pain. She half spun around the scaffolding pole, lunging for a crossbar as the shot twisted her around. The briefcase dropped, bounced on one corner, and fell by the far edge of the platform. Get back out here, Jack repeated slowly. Megan had regained her balance. She shuffled reluctantly forward again, whimpering. Her right shoe was a ruined mess of leather and blood. She couldn't put weight on it, so she slid down and sat on the wooden planks of the external platform. It was a defensive posture, but Jack knew it made her more dangerous because she knew she was completely cornered. I only want to refuel my ship and leave Earth, she pleaded. Let me go! Can't do that. Jack moved closer, raising the gun to aim at her head again. Look at what's happening already. Your ship's causing this typhoon. Launching it would generate a tsunami that would barrel down the Bristol Channel and out into the Atlantic. Megan stretched out a tentative hand and tugged the briefcase towards her from where it balanced precariously at the edge of the platform. Even this small effort made her grimace in pain. She flicked the catches at the top and lifted the lid. Jack stepped towards her, but as the lid lifted, his Geiger counter started to crackle and spit its radiation warning. Jack hesitated briefly, and that was enough to allow Megan time to reach into the briefcase and bring out two foil-wrapped items. Megan looked up at him. You're going to help me. No, I'm not. It wasn't a question. Give me the revolver, Jack, and then you're going to escort me back to my ship, or I'll throw these things into the street and contaminate the whole area. Jack peered down at her pityingly. He'd taken something out of his greatcoat pocket with his left hand. He held it up so she could see it in the flashes of lightning. Radiation sponge. It's absorbing the stuff right now. Megan took a deep breath, considered her options, slowly raised her hands above her head. It wasn't a gesture of surrender. Then I'll slap these things together. The explosion will spread radioactive fragments so far across the city that you won't be able to mop it up with 1,000 of those things. 10,000! It'll kill you too! She was smiling again now. I have options. And you'll have no fuel. I'll start again. And I'd like to tell you that I'll see you again, Jack, except that you won't survive the explosion. Her hands moved apart. Jack fired as she brought them together. They never met. The shot took her above the left eyebrow, her head jerked back, and the movement threw her hands forward. The fuel packet spun from her grip and hit the wooden walkway with a clunk. Megan's upper body continued to fall back. The weight carried her over the edge.
For a moment, it seemed like the green netting behind her would hold her up, until a gust of wind lifted it, and she slid off the platform and into the plastic debris chute. A sequence of clanks and thuds slowly faded as Megan's body bounced and rattled down the chute. In the medical suite at the hub, Gwen was startled to see movement in the bed. Owen's eyes snapped open. He looked around wildly, struggling to rise from the pillow. His eyes widened as he took in his surroundings. "Hey, hey!" She hurried over to the bedside to comfort him. "It's okay." "I'm in..." He struggled with his words and thoughts, as though he was coming back to full consciousness. "I'm in the hub?" "Hang on. I'll get you a glass of water." She went over to the basin to refill his glass. "How are you feeling?" "Fine," he said from behind her. "So much better than I thought was possible." Jack waded downhill to the phone box. With no signal from any mobile, he needed a landline to make urgent contact with the hub. He spotted the box as he crested the hill of the side road. The SUV was still visible, clear of the water that was swirling around this lower-lying road. The cold water eddied around his knees and soaked through his trousers. Yanto eventually answered the call. "What kept you?" asked Jack. "Okay, so the system wouldn't have recognized this number. I'm using a payphone, and I'm practically up to my ass in water." Yanto wasn't responding to the banter as he usually did. "What's wrong?" Jack asked. Gwen and Toshiko found Owen and brought him back. They thought he was injured, but he's woken up and attacked Gwen, tried to bite her in the neck. We think he's being controlled by one of those devices inserted in his spine. So that's why Megan was so placid at the end. She had options, remembered Jack. "I don't understand. Sorry, Yanto," thinking aloud. "You're right. Owen is not himself. He's being controlled by the same thing that took Wildman and B. Are Gwen and Tosh okay?" "Yes, they're tracking him down." Jack could hear a muttered conversation somewhere in the background. "They've located his mobile signal in the basement. Our internal network's still up." "Okay, Yanto. The thing controlling Owen knows everything he knows, so it knows its way around the hub. It won't need the fuel cells. Once it works out, it can harvest the materials we've got down there. I'm coming back in. You and Tosh concentrate on finding Owen. Have Gwen meet me at the base of the water tower with scuba gear." The sound of the pips interrupted him. Jack yelled urgently but clearly over them, "Find Owen! You cannot let him out of the basement. Subdue him if you can, and Yanto? Yes? Kill him if you can't." Gwen didn't like sitting alone in the hub, not at the best of times. This was worse, sitting by a computer terminal in the hub while Yanto and Toshiko tracked Owen through the basement. At least she could guide them while she waited for Jack to return. She watched their identification icon slide silently across the computer schematic that showed the labyrinth of interconnecting tunnels that crisscrossed the Torchwood basement. Gwen listened to the hum of the computers, the drip of water, the occasional rustle from the pterodactyl up in the rafters above the second floor. The ping of an alarm drew her attention to a second display. It showed a high view of the surrounding area, seen from the top of the Silver Water Tower. Only the humped outline of the Millennium Center's entrance made the image recognizable. The evening light had faded dramatically under the leaden skies, and sheets of rain swept over an expanse of murky water. The bay water flooded right up as far as the tower and completely obscured the paving stones. The alarm detected changes in heat signals from the immediate area. At the top of the image, there was the imposing outline of Jack Harkness making his way knee-deep through the water. He had his head down against the prevailing wind, and his greatcoat trailed in a wake through the storm water behind him. He splashed his way to the paving slab by the water tower and activated the lift. The relative calm of the hub was disrupted at once. A square column of dirty water began to cascade from the ceiling as the paving slab began its descent. Within seconds, Jack was visible above it, like a drenched statue on a tall liquid plinth. "Close it! Close it!" he spluttered down to her. Gwen fumbled with an override control, and a replacement paving slab slotted into place and shut off the flow of water as abruptly as it had begun. She made her way over to the lift's hydraulic pole. The basin in the center of the hub was overflowing with water now, so she negotiated her way across by clinging to a higher walkway. A fish briefly broke the surface of the pool as Gwen shuffled tentatively across. The slab reached floor level. Jack was soaked from head to toe. She helped him as he shrugged off his drenched coat. Take your brolly next time, eh? Must be in the car, he smiled. I left the SUV a couple of streets back, uphill. Thought I could drive all the way back, but wasn't sure where to drop anchor. Don't worry, said Gwen. No traffic wardens out in that storm. It's not going to be towed away. Jack had sauntered over to the basin. He was sopping wet, so he didn't seem to care about wading across through the floodwater. You got the scuba gear I asked for? Gwen indicated a pile of equipment on the other side of the basin. Suit up, said Jack. Aren't we going to help Yanto and Tosh find Owen? Jack was already stripping off his outer clothes. No time. That ship you found, it's still coming through the rift. You and me can best help Owen by getting back there. Getting back there how? Jack pointed at the flooded basin that separated them across the hub. This is a tidal pool. There are some valves and safeguards to negotiate on the way, but it's the fastest route. The ship will have come much further through the rift now because it's displaced a huge amount of water in the bay. Come on, get your gear on. The cell tunnels invariably smelled damp. Yanto could always tell if one of the team had been down there. All clear, hissed Toshiko. She raised her gun and moved quickly into the next corridor. The lower basement was filthy. No point trying to keep it clean, Yanto knew. He wondered why Owen would choose to flee down here. The signal on Yanto's PDA told him that Owen was still in the middle of the three main cells. He hadn't moved from the area for 15 minutes now. He seemed to be wandering between the different cells. Toshiko pushed open the dungeon door. There were three glass-fronted cells to one side of a short corridor. Opposite were three more cells behind solid doors with tiny square windows. Once Yanto was in the corridor with her, Toshiko pulled a lever in the wall to seal the main door behind them. The cage strip light hung above from the ceiling. It cast a pallid glow over the whole corridor. The three cells had their own internal lights, which showed up the grimy marks that smeared the glass fronts. Yanto knew that they had a weevil secured in the middle cell, though the glass was angled up so it was difficult to see where the creature was at the moment. Hang on, Yanto put his hand on Toshiko's shoulder. Yanto had worked out why light was sliding off the glass in the middle cell differently, why he couldn't see the weevil inside. The cell was open. He checked the PDA again. Owen's signal was behind him. He could smell the foul stench of something breathing close by. Something snorted in his ear, belched and growled. He whirled round, shouldering Toshiko aside from the creature behind them. The weevil must have been lurking in one of the other cells, unseen behind the heavy studded door. Toshiko scurried aside as best she could, scuffling across the floor on her backside. The sound distracted the weevil for a second, just enough time for Yanto. He snatched the device he'd been carrying from his pocket and plunged it into the gap at the top of the weevil's overalls. It connected with her neck, below the chin and her slavering fangs. The weevil barely had time to twist her head towards him before he slid the activation switch on the gadget. Her eyes stared into his briefly, and then squeezed closed in agony as the device sent a disabling jolt through her whole body. She slammed backwards, smashing into the fire hose reel on the opposite wall. Yanto pressed forward, holding the thing against her neck as she slid down the slimy bricks. The weevil's eyes were closed now. Yanto stepped back, breathless, dazed, relieved. Toshiko clambered back to her feet and brushed the dirt from her trousers. Yanto stooped down to grab the weevil's ankles and dragged her back into her cell. Something tumbled from the pocket in the weevil's overalls and clattered onto the floor. That explains a lot. Yanto showed it to Toshiko. Owen's mobile phone. The ship rattled and lurched. The corridors stretched into a misty haze ahead of them, just as Gwen remembered. The same green-tinged gloom interspersed by brilliant flashes, the same gusts of hot, sour steam from half-seen vents along their route. When she'd struggled out of here with Sandra Applegate's body, she'd hoped that was the last she'd ever see of this place. She shrugged her shoulders to detach the diving cylinder and dropped her mask next to it. Jack clearly had no such worries. He was already marching down the walkway, ducking to avoid catching his head on the bizarre fronds and tendrils that curled from up in the ceiling. "This place is alive," he called back to her. "I know. I've never seen anything like it." "No," he chided. "I mean,
You didn't turn it off when you were last here. We have to do that first.
First?
What else did he have in mind? He was already striding away again. Gwen hurried to catch up. Jack was taking this whole alien ship thing so calmly, as though he'd seen hundreds of them in his career. He wasn't casual about it. She could tell that from the way he handled the harpoon gun as he made careful progress down the walkway. But he was measured, assured. She chased after him. The ship rocked and juddered erratically around them, and she struggled to keep her balance. She caught up with Jack in the open expanse that contained the circle of suspended cages. He was still wearing his diving cylinder with his mask dangled over his shoulder. He wriggled out of the scuba set and placed the harpoon gun on the floor so that it was carefully pointed away from him and Gwen. Jack studied the cylindrical block that squatted in the exact center of the circle. Gwen didn't see how he did it, but with a few deft movements of his fingers, he activated the cylinder. The top spiraled apart like a time-lapse film of a flower head unfurling its petals. Two softly illuminated hemispherical panels unfolded from inside and presented themselves like a remorseful supplicant offering his open palms to Jack. He was intent on operating the two panels in front of him. He continued to manipulate them for several minutes until he stood back and folded his arms. He grinned hugely. "There you go." Even as he was speaking, the buffeting movements of the ship were dying down. "What happened?" "Put it into reverse gear," he explained. "Not enough power left for a secure return, so it'll tear itself apart as it heads back through the rift. Still, the wreckage won't be littering the bay. And it'll cause less damage around it than on its journey in." He nodded at the harpoon gun on the floor. "It's like the barbs on that spear. Goes through more easily in the right direction. At the moment, it's like the ship's trying to go the wrong way, and that's what's causing all this local trauma." Gwen looked more closely at the hemispherical panels that Jack had somehow manipulated to control the alien ship. She couldn't identify any switches or dials. All she could see were softly glowing areas of color. "And you can just control it." "It's a Broydak battlecruiser," he said. "Nothing too tricky here." Jack began to examine one of the suspended cages, exploring its innards with his fingers. The largest of the suspended cages was sealed shut. The cage glowed softly with an inner radiance. Its rich, translucent blue-green surface had a glassy luster that reminded Gwen of Chinese ornaments. Jack leaned towards it and manipulated the front with a series of hand and arm gestures. With the hissing sound of a vacuum release, the front of the cage split in two and peeled backwards.
"Now that is ugly," Jack said.
The occupant was a large humanoid. If it had stood, it would have been more than 7 feet tall. In the caged frame, it sat in a scooped position, its knees slightly lifted and its long claws clutched near its chest, so that it appeared like a monstrously large fetus. Its bare skull had a ridge of bony protrusions that began at the bridge of its nose and continued over the back of the head. Its mouth was a gash in the bottom of its flat, cruel face, and it sucked in air with shallow breaths. Beneath its heavy closed lids, the creature's eyes were moving, as though it was dreaming. Tubing and wires were connected from its scarred torso into flickering shapes of light in the side of the cage. Gwen wandered in front of the suspended creature, fascinated and repulsed in equal measure. A hand on her shoulder moved her to one side. She twisted her head to see that Jack was weighing the harpoon gun in his hands, aiming the wicked spike at the trapped alien. Gwen considered the look in Jack's eyes. "You can't, Jack. It's helpless." Jack never took his eyes off the creature in front of him. It was almost as though he suspected he would falter if he met Gwen's searching, disbelieving gaze. "It's controlling Owen. It's murdered others. It would have destroyed this whole area." "No, Jack." He hefted the harpoon gun higher. "It surrendered the right to survive." The trigger clicked. The harpoon spear shot forward and penetrated the creature's chest, just above its folded claws. The barbed spike continued through the body and out the back of the cage. Jack braced his feet on the floor, took a grip of the unspooled wire that was still attached to the spear, and pulled back with all his weight. The reverse side of the barbed spike caught on the rear of the cage, until Jack tugged it one more time and the brittle casing shattered. The entire spear pulled back through the creature's chest.
The Buridak warrior's eyes snapped open, red and wide and appalled. Its arms jerked out in an uncontrolled gesture, and for a fleeting moment Gwen imagined it begging, pleading. The spiked barb of the harpoon clattered to the floor in front of the cage, and the warrior slumped lifeless in its cage. Jack concealed the remains of the ravaged body with the broken cage doors. The catch was broken and would not fasten, so he pulled the front pieces together as best he could. Gwen rounded on him. The creature had frightened her, revolted her even. But Jack's cold-blooded execution had nauseated her more. "You didn't have to do that." "No?" He stared her down. "It's controlling Owen. It still is. I don't know any other way of helping him. You got a better idea, maybe?" "I don't know," she yelled angrily. "What makes me the expert all of a sudden?"
"Well, maybe that will make it easier for you to do this next thing for me."
Gwen didn't want to listen anymore. And she couldn't abandon Jack and retrace her steps down those corridors and find her way back to the hub alone. Jack would know that, of course, and was able to make some further adjustments to the controls in the central cylinder while she scowled at him from the edge of the room. All the time, Jack continued talking, explaining what he was doing, what he was going to do, and the things he needed her to do. She didn't want to listen, but she found that she had to, and the more she did, the greater her dread became. His work at the cylinder completed, Jack walked over to one of the hanging cages. It was the same one that they'd found Owen in. Without any hesitation, Jack sat in the chair of the cage. "Strap me in," he said to her. She hesitated. "Do it!" Gwen found her hands were trembling. "Tighter," Jack insisted. She completed the final fastening. Jack was pinned into the cage. His hands were free, but he could not reach the straps that bound him around the neck, shoulder, and upper arms. He could move his head just enough to peer down his nose at his watch. "Running out of time," he told her. "Listen, Gwen, if this doesn't work, you'll have to explain to the others." Gwen reached out to him, placed her palm softly against his cheek. He twisted his head as though her hand had burned him. "Knock it off," he snarled. "Stay focused. Do not, I repeat, do not change the plan. You do exactly as we agreed, understand?" She nodded. "Say it," he snapped. "Understand?" "I understand." "You must not let me change this plan," he urged, "no matter how much I may threaten you, no matter how much I plead with you or beg you." Gwen could hardly bear to meet the blue intensity of his gaze. "All right," Jack said. "Hit the button." Gwen reached down behind the cage and activated the control Jack had shown her. The cage quivered into life around him. With a brief cough, the mechanism punched a Buridak device through the skin of his back and into his spine. Jack bellowed in surprise, a roar that seemed to fill the whole cavernous room and that Gwen thought would never end. Eventually, Jack reverted to a series of anguished gasps. "Not what I expected," he told her, and slipped into unconsciousness. Toshiko sat alone at her computer terminal in the main hub area. Her desk was stacked high with half-repaired components, scribbled notes, and an assortment of pens. Flat panel screens flickered in front of her eyes, displaying the latest results of her search around the hub for Owen's life signs. At first, she'd worried about being too obviously exposed in the center of the area. She reassured herself that Owen was not armed when he fled from the medical suite, and that she had now securely locked the armory. He might be able to spot her by looking down from the gantry by the boardroom, or from beside the cog-shaped entrance where the lift delivered people from the upper floors. But he would not be able to pick her off from either place. The idea was that it appeared she would have enough time to make a run for it, and when she heard his footsteps on the metal gantry or detected the noise of the door opening behind her. She was still in a state of some anxiety, though. That much was evident when the tannoy system sounded, and she simply leaped out of her seat and practically whirled on the spot in panic as she realized that she had no idea where she was going to run. Her breathing was shallow, ragged, panicked. It felt like her heart was battering her ribcage. "You're very difficult to reach," said Gwen's voice over the tannoy. "That's the idea," said Toshiko. "Oh, God, Gwen, you scared me to death." "Sorry, I'm using some comms device that Jack brought along." He connected it to the Torchwood PA system, just as well because your mobile still switched off. There was a clattering noise from the gallery. Toshiko looked up momentarily, distracted. Nothing to see.
No sign of Owen yet, she told Gwen. I think he may have gone to ground.
Thank God, replied Gwen. Things seem to have gone completely tits up here. We've managed to stop the ship coming through the rift.
Well, that's great news.
But Jack's got himself trapped in the place we found Owen. The place where he got that thing stuck in him.
Oh, Tosh.
Toshiko was torn between comforting Gwen and warning her. You have to be careful, Gwen. You're broadcasting on an open channel. Whatever I can hear, Owen can hear too.
I don't care.
There was a sob in Gwen's voice. She was starting to lose it, thought Toshiko. Her hand hovered over the disconnect button.
Tosh, he's trapped in the machinery.
It's all gone so horribly wrong. He's had one of those control devices injected into him. What am I going to do?
Toshiko didn't have time to answer. There was a clattering, clanking sound from the gallery beside the coffee machine. There was a blur of motion. The looped chain by the railing rattled and swayed. Owen had slid down it and was plunging through the raised level of water in the basin, unstoppable, desperate to reach her. In his hand was an evil-looking surgical instrument. He made the near side of the basin before she had time to turn and flee. He was right beside her. She spun on her heel, ready to run. Owen plunged forward, the hammer raised. Within seconds, Yanto was on him, water spraying all around the area. Owen's eyes stretched wide, unbelieving, furious. Yanto took full advantage of his disorientation and smashed him hard across the face with the back of his hand. Owen was no match for the bigger man, and Yanto was able to twist the hammer from his grasp and cast it aside. It bounced off under the nearby desk with the chime of metal on metal. Yanto sat on Owen's chest, pinning him to the floor. He plucked a syringe from his pocket and one-handed popped the protective cap off the needle before plunging it into Owen. Toshiko was beside him now.
Nice work, Yanto.
Owen slurred at her from beneath Yanto.
Don't be too pleased with yourself, Tosh. I heard that call from Gwen.
What do you mean?
His eyes flickered on the edge of unconsciousness. I have another life left. Back in my ship. Your friend Jack.
Owen swallowed hard, took a deep breath, exhaled it.
Got a feeling he's gonna be the most useful of all. He summoned up the strength to wink at Yanto. See you again. Soon.
After she'd contacted Toshiko, Gwen sat quietly with her back to the central cylinder. The churning, lurching movements of the alien vessel had begun to subside now, and the flickering of green lights in the unseen ceiling was settling into a regular, uninterrupted illumination of the area around her. She studied Jack from a distance. His breathing was regular, but he remained deeply unconscious. Gwen mentally rehearsed the sequence of events that Jack had explained earlier, but now he was trapped in the cage. Nothing seemed clear anymore. Everything seemed wrong. Impossible. Jack took a sudden shuddering breath, like a man surfacing from water and gratefully gulping at the air. His eyes widened, accustomed themselves to the light, focused on Gwen.
Hey, he said cheerfully.
I was beginning to think things weren't working out. Gwen forced herself up from the floor, turned her back on him, began to operate the panels that sprouted from the top of the control cylinder, just the way Jack had shown her. The urge was to rely on what she knew from Earth technology, to feel the reassuring click of a light switch or hear the firm clunk that a car door makes that tells you it's closed. Her short training session at these controls with Jack earlier had made her nervous and frustrated. It was more a mental contact than a physical one. She began to doubt that she'd manipulated them correctly until she heard the sound of running water in the distance. She panicked for a moment, realizing that her scuba gear was a long way from her down the corridors, until she saw Jack's mask and diving cylinder on the floor. She snatched it up and tried to remain calm as she slipped the harness on her back, strapped it across her midriff, fitted the mask over her eyes and nose. The water began to gush into the chamber. It swilled across the floor and swirled against the central cylinder and around her feet. In his cage, still clear of the incoming water, Jack's eyes registered his alarm.
Okay, you can let me out of here now, Gwen.
She continued to check that her scuba set was working.
Gwen!
The cylinder was half full and open. The air hoses were securely attached and not kinked.
Come on, Gwen, you can let me out now.
She adjusted her mask, getting it comfortable. Not time yet to put the mouthpiece in.
The cramped cage couldn't be comfortable for Jack, but he was showing her his biggest, cheesiest, most reassuring grin. Tosh did it, you know. She trapped Owen. He's locked in the cells, so it's okay to undo these straps now, Gwen. We did it. We can get out of here. You mean I can get out of here, she told him. No, that was a mistake. Jack told her not to talk to him, not to get drawn into a conversation. She bit her bottom lip in frustration and annoyance. Jack saw it, knew he was getting through. The incoming water was splashing up against the bottom of the cages now. Gwen leaned back against the cylinder and looked at Jack. He winked at her. Time to go, Gwen. Place is flooding. You warned me not to listen to you. That was then, and this is now. A note of studied exasperation in his voice. You said it yourself, my plan's gone so horribly wrong. Completely tits up. He could evidently see from her reaction that what he'd said had surprised her. How very interesting, Jack. Now how would you know I said that? His eagerness was evolving into worry, and then anger, as she continued to speak, because you were unconscious when I called Tosh. So either you were faking it, which wouldn't be good, or you heard it when you were possessing Owen, which would be even worse. Please, Gwen, this really isn't what I planned. The level had reached his waist now. He wriggled impotently as the cold gray water lapped around him in the cage. Please, Gwen, I'm begging you. Pleading? She asked him. That's so not Jack. God damn it! He flared, shaking the cage as he struggled against his restraints. This is me now, up to my ass in seawater. You think I'm going to reason with you, Police Constable Cooper? Think I'm going to conduct a debate with you? Observe the niceties of reasoned argument? Get me the hell out of here! The water had reached her chest now. No more time to talk with Jack. Gwen inserted the mouthpiece. She ensured that there was a watertight seal between the breathing set and her lips. Water slopped around her face and ears. She could hear her own breathing as she tried to inhale through her mouth regularly, calmly. Still, she watched Jack in the cage, as the churning seawater eddied around him. He was shouting at her still, his bound hands thrashing and scratching at the bars in a futile effort to release them. Jack wailed and pleaded and screamed at her. The last thing she could hear before the water rose over her ears were his threats. If you don't release these clasps for me, I will get out of here once the water has short-circuited the system. You will regret this! I will make you regret this! The water continued to rise over her face mask. You're unable to keep your temper. The anger and desolation and anguish consume you. It's not like the hunger this time. Not the exquisite agony of physical want. It's the knowledge that you are no longer in control. The sea has reached your chin now. It's cold and dark, and there is no comfort for you in its chill embrace. With your mouth clamped shut, you can just angle your head a little higher, keeping your nose and eyes above the water, staring at the top of the cage. The last thing you expected to see. And the last thing you will see. You consider what's inside yourself now. What there will be next. And it is so dark and lonely and empty. You knew that Sandra Applegate believed in everlasting life and a better place to go. Guy Wildman's unreasoned agnosticism allowed for something beyond death. But when you explore your heart now, there is nothing inside you. Nothing. Blankness. Blackness. Close your eyes now. How long can you hold your breath? Your lungs burn. They ache for air. Every fiber of your being is telling you to open your mouth and your eyes. You so want somewhere to go from here, but you don't remotely believe there is anywhere left. You are not B or Wildman or Teg. You are not like them. You know there is nothing more. Jack's face was underwater now, angled up to the last pocket of air in the cage. With her head underwater, too, everything seemed closer to Gwen. Images were magnified, even in the grayish seawater. The sound of her own breathing, the noise of exhaled air, was loud and close.
She wasn't sure she could bear to watch this, but knew somehow she wouldn't look away. That wasn't Jack in the cage anymore, cajoling and begging and threatening, thrashing at the restraints in fury and desperation. It was the Broidak warrior. So wasn't she just doing the same thing that Jack did earlier? Didn't that make her the same? Or knowing that about herself, didn't it make her worse? The bubbles from Jack's upturned face slowed to a trickle and stopped. His eyelids opened. His mouth gaped abruptly as the breathing reflex overcame him. His chest convulsed as he sucked cold gray water into his lungs in a final choking rush. Cold gray seawater surrounded Gwen so she couldn't feel the hot salt tears on her face. She forced herself to watch Jack until his seizures subsided. Once he hadn't moved for 10 minutes, she knew for certain that Jack was dead. The mesh grating tilted up and over and toppled with a clanging echo. Gwen emerged from beneath it, surging out of the water into the basin and sending waves slopping over the edges across the hub floor. Through the mask, she could see that she had broken the surface. She tore it off and eagerly gasped down fresh air, or as fresh as it got in the hub. Even the slightly damp atmosphere of the main level made her feel home and safe. Behind her, Jack's body floated face down in the water of the hub basin. She had released it from the bonds of the cage in the ship and desperately dragged it behind her through flooded corridors, along an open stretch of the bay, and finally through the interlocking junctions of the hub's underwater entrance. She'd found Jack's body a dead weight while it was in the water. Now she tried to drag it from the basin. It was more of a struggle than she'd anticipated. Her body was telling her to stop, to rest. Gwen's legs and arms throbbed with dull pain, and she had to fight for her breath. Eventually, she got her hands under his armpits and half-dragged him, half-fell with him onto the hub floor. Why wasn't he reviving? She'd seen him take a bullet in the forehead and return to life. But she didn't know for certain if anything could kill him. Gwen? Toshiko hurried across the basin to join her. Gwen hardly registered that the walkway had now reemerged as the water subsided. She was too preoccupied in devising some excuse about what had happened to Jack, why she was pressing her face to his. But if he was dead, then what was the whole bloody point? Jack had to abandon his scuba gear halfway back from the ship, she lied. Ran out of oxygen, only for a short time. She could barely speak now. Toshiko's look was grave. Gwen? She began gently. How long has he been without air? Gwen didn't know what to say anymore, didn't know how to explain. She gave a little shriek of surprise. Jack had abruptly rolled over towards her and barfed seawater over her legs. Her shriek turned into a shout of elation and then to laughter. She threw herself on him and hugged him tight, let him go almost immediately as he began to choke in her embrace, apologized when he slipped back and smacked his head on the floor. Laughed again, laughed, and thought she'd never stop. The Casa Celli was almost deserted. No rowdy bankers or ladies who lunched had braved the bright afternoon sun. The high street was largely empty of people, too. There was so much mud silt washed up along its length that it wasn't always clear where the pavement ended and the carriageway began. The water from the bay may have subsided as suddenly as it had risen over central Cardiff, but many of the shops and businesses remained closed. Through most streets, the residual sludge wasn't the only thing left behind by the retreating water. There was the human detritus of food scraps and fast food cartons, shredded paper and cans, a solitary soggy striped pillow. Post boxes had a ring round them, dirty tide marks that showed how far the water had reached. The cafe doors were firmly closed, despite the warm afternoon sun. It kept the foul smell of mud out in the street. Gwen and Toshiko sat at one small table by the window. Jack and Owen sat at the next one alone. They were positioned by the front window so that they could look out into the street, alert for any sign of weevils. Jack had also placed the anti-weevil spray on his table, in plain view next to his tall glass of water. Gwen thought it more prudent to conceal the hand clamps beneath her table. Owen had barely spoken to any of them, since Jack had discharged them both from the medical suite in the hub. Jack had made some excuse about an increase in the number of free-roaming weevils in the last 48 hours, and that many more of the creatures seemed to have been flushed out from the sewers by the recent flooding. When they'd arrived at Casa Celli half an hour ago,
He'd made Gwen and Toshiko sit at a separate table. Gwen sipped her lemonade, listening in to Jack's sporadic, almost one-sided conversation with Owen. Jack took his eyes from the window for the first time since he sat down. He looked closely at Owen. "You know that I recruited you all because you're the best, don't you?" Owen nodded dumbly. "It's a gut thing," Jack explained, "an instinct. Not something you can pass or fail a test on. And it's not something I'm going to judge you on, Owen. You each earn my respect every day." Owen couldn't hold Jack's gaze. He distracted himself by swirling his slice of lemon round in the bottom of his Coke glass. "Hard as it may seem now," Jack continued, "Megan was a part of your life before Torchwood. You are doing more to save others now than you ever were back in A&E. That's the old world. That's gone now. She's gone." "Don't you think I know that?" snapped Owen. His angular face was pink now, suffused with barely contained fury. "Not what I mean, Owen." Jack kept his steady gaze on the angry man. He would not back down, would not apologize. "Your whole existence in A&E, you can't return there. You're so way beyond that now. You can't go back to that time, that place, those people. You're living another life. It's the 21st century. We have to help them be ready for it." He took Owen's hand and placed something in his palm. It was the Becquerin deep tissue scanner that he'd retrieved from the hospital room. "And giving them alien technology helps no one in the long run." Owen looked like he was about to say something, but abruptly, there was no time for more chat. They were all startled by a face at the window, fuzzy pale hair, grizzled weather-beaten skin, and a permanent scowl of anger and bemusement. If they'd been shocked by the weevil, Gwen thought, well, that was nothing to what it must have felt when it saw four humans on the other side of the glass leap to their feet. Jack grabbed for the spray in front of him, scattering half-finished drinks all over the table in the process. Gwen and Toshiko scrambled awkwardly beneath their table for the hand clamps. Owen, meanwhile, was already in hot pursuit of the weevil, first through the cafe door and into the mud-cake street, ahead of them all. Torchwood, Another Life, written by Peter Angelides, was read by John Barrowman. It was produced by Anna Lee and is published by BBC Audiobooks.